Yeah, my pleasure.
I'm like I said, I'm talking to a bunch of different people, and then I'm going to write up some of my own things, and then I'm going to do a different kind of thing than I usually do, where I just get a panel together and have everybody talk over each other. I wanted to do this just in a different format, and I felt like this was a sort of a special occasion.
Well, every night I have, for as long as I can remember, taped Late Show with David Letterman. And this morning was the first time in probably a year that I've actually sat down and watched an episode of Late Show with David Letterman.
Yeah, one of the things that I'm going to talk about, I actually had a few people say, I don't know if you want me on your thing because I haven't seen it in years. But part of the story I think I'm going to tell is that this is the way of the world, which is you start as an upstart and you end as an elder statesman. And yep. I feel like with Letterman, that's the case. I have seen probably 5 episodes in the last year.
I will give him this. Johnny Carson was square even when big portions of America thought he was hip, or he was square America's idea of hip. And David Letterman, his flavor lasted, I think, a lot longer than anyone, including himself, expected it to. And then when he finally became hopelessly identified with Dad, he still, by that time, he felt like, well, he was just a good friend, and there were all these other choices that I could turn to. And so he just stuck around, and it worked out okay for everybody, not least of all David Letterman.
When we think about Carson, I mean, you mentioned Carson, and I actually wanted to start with Carson. My memory of Carson is very much somebody born in 1970. My memory of Carson is he was, and part of it is he was establishment. He was the old guy who had always, forever, my entire life, been on at 11:30, and he was just there. And but I'll tell you, when I discovered David Letterman, I recorded Carson's monologue. I watched Carson's monologue. I didn't dislike Carson. I just sort of, the whole showbiz thing and the people he'd interview, I didn't understand that. But I appreciated Carson. And I had internalized what a talk show was from Carson, right? And I think that was the initial power of what David Letterman was doing, is that it was all about being, ways to subvert the Tonight Show, essentially. Not in a negative way, but to do things different. It was like a satire of, or parody of, or skewed, ironic version of the real thing, which was on at 11:30.
I was 15 years old in the summer of 1980 when David Letterman got his morning show. And everybody knew David Letterman had no business doing a morning show. But that was the slot that NBC had for him. And in that day of very constrained, sphinctered television programming schedules and priorities, you made the best with what you had. He did game shows as well. He was a whiz at Password and Pyramid. And whenever they could, they shoehorned him in, on one of – whenever Johnny was taking a vacation, which was usually tomorrow.
Yeah, frequently.
They worked him in. But for him to have his own platform, other than an occasional television special, they had to give him something. And so he did morning television as nobody has ever done morning television. And the response to that, I mean, they canceled him, as we all knew he would, NBC would, because the housewives, who made up the bulk of daytime TV viewing in 1980, did not get David Letterman. But the rest of us who were on summer vacation that summer, we flocked to this show. And when NBC announced that they were canceling him, people flocked to 30 Rock to sit in the aisles even and pose a fire hazard, as Letterman famously pointed out in one of his shows, and be part of what they thought was television history. And so when he came back for good on February 1st of 1982, it was already established that he would be doing the anti-Johnny Carson show. What he had already done to morning television, he was going to do to late night television and then some.
And what's funny is, of course, that this was all part of also of Carson's negotiations with NBC. He wanted to cut back to an hour, and he wanted control of the time slot that followed him. And so, you know, this was, you know, anti-Johnny Carson in the sense of being a satire. But, you know, David Letterman had nothing, but as far as I can tell, you know, Johnny Carson was a hero of David Letterman's. And so, and Carson owned the show. So it's kind of brilliant, right? Carson owns the show that is subverting the format that Carson owns.
Yes. Yes. But Johnny Carson also had a very strong survival instinct. And even though he would sometimes joke about, you know, he had those jokes when his monologue was dying, he had those saver jokes. And one of his more famous one was, should I just walk off now and let Letterman take over the show? Johnny, despite kidding about it, knew that he needed to step up his game, and he needed also to protect his turf. And in 1980, when you're the king of late night, what you mostly do is protect your turf. So he dictated terms to David Letterman, who, although Dave adored Johnny, was put under some rather humiliating, I think, creative constraints. The first of which was he was not allowed to have a band of more than four members, and he was not allowed to tell more than, I think, four jokes in his opening monologue. And several other features that Dave would not be allowed to have on his show, it remind anybody of the Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson.
They had guest booking limitations, like no guests who'd been on the Tonight Show recently. Yep. They had, I think, was he not told to not be topical in his monologue too?
Well, whether or not he was told not to be topical. And Meryl Marco, who was his girlfriend and writer on the show, said, "Hallelujah! I mean, we're delighted to have these rules and restrictions, because it means we don't have to do the Johnny Carson show. It means we're free to go off and turn everything on its head." And so it was a pretty slippery slope from four non-topical jokes in the monologue in a small band to Paul Schaefer's rants storming out the door and Chris Elliott coming out from behind the seats and Dave putting on a suit of sponges and jumping in a giant bowl of Rice Krispies and so on. He decided he would raid everybody else's talk show treasure chest, first and foremost Steve Allen.
Right.
But also you could definitely see Jack Parr and of course his hero Regis Philbin all wound up sort of on his stage because he was under strict orders to not be Johnny, and it worked out great for him. We don't know, because demographics were not widely circulated in the 1980s. They were not even widely measured really until the 1990s, but the market research that NBC did internally showed that within a very short period of time, younger people were preferring Letterman to Carson. And this was driving all kinds of advertising sales. And really, whether it was true in public or not, there was a genuine business competition going on now between the 11:30 and 12:30 shows on NBC late night. And this is the thing that people don't always think about, but had that kind of demographic research been done in 1990, 1991, 1992, the time when Jay Leno and his manager, Helen Kushnick, were making the big press for him to succeed Johnny Carson as the host of The Tonight Show, what if Dave's camp had been able to point to those sheets of demographics and the news media had access to that kind of research showing that among 18 to 34-year-old male viewers, Dave was beating the pants off of both Johnny and Jay. How would late night history have been different if that kind of data that we now take for granted had been widely circulating then?
As a as a teenager watching David Letterman, I was trying to think. I've been reflecting about this. What attracted us all to David Letterman in the 80s? And I think my theory is, you do internalize the rules of television in the 70s, right? The rules of television. You're allowed some. There's good-natured banter above the format. So your Match Games, your Hollywood Squares, and the Tonight Show, right? There's banter and there's jokes and things like that.
Above, double entendres.
Yeah, but it's above the format, right? And I think the moment that crystallized for me, I don't remember the moment when I decided, oh my God, David Letterman. It was just the show was not, like, the format was being undermined. And that was, to me, that, and I guess you could boil it down to the introduction of irony to every, yeah. And just breaking it up, that entire format. But for me, that was the moment that unlocked the possibilities, and that's what got me hooked on the show. Does that sound right to you? Is that basically the thing that made this thing appeal to this whole other generation in the early to mid 80s?
Well, David Letterman didn't invent irony, and he didn't even invent it on television. That was what SNL did in the 1970s. What was different about Letterman was that he just made it so much more broadly humorous and accessible. Even though he famously, you know, didn't smile or laugh at his own jokes, except to mock himself, Letterman really was a lot easier to take than Mr. Mike or Eddie Murphy or any of the kind of the, you know, edgier comics that graced the Saturday Night Live arena. But there's no doubt that the reception of SNL, whose creator Lorne Michaels also never wanted to be like Johnny Carson's show, that really did set the stage for what he did. But the difference, of course, is that SNL did, 22, 24 episodes a year? And Letterman did 200.
Right.
So he had to do stuff every night. He had to have recurring bits. He had to have, you know, the late night thrill cam went on forever. That's where we got the top 10 list, which finally is going to be put to rest after, I think, several efforts to try to kill it off. Who had done successful back in the early days.
People don't remember. I remember the first top 10 list. It was literally just another bit to replace an old bit. I can't even remember what the old bit was. Al Frisch's flights to Europe or something. I mean, it was literally just another stupid bit that would go on for a week.
And from the home office in Milwaukee.
Yeah, and it went on forever.
and Wahoo, Nebraska, famously.
Yeah, Tahlequah, lately. Oklahoma.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Those bits really, what was so effective about them, of course, was that a generation could claim them as their own, right? Stupid Petrix and Dave in the Velcro suit,
right?
And Chris Elliott and Biff Henderson and
Larry Bud Melman, right?
I mean, and Larry Bud Melman handing out hot towels to arriving visitors at the Port Authority bus terminal.
And showing amazingly bad microphone technique, which I found so endearing. Yeah. How long have you been in this?
How long do you plan to stay here? Yeah, he was just priceless. And what's interesting about the move to CBS – which was, of course, despite the great disappointment of not getting the Tonight Show, it was at that time such a triumphal entry. And people, you know, it's hard even to imagine the kind of excitement. But even then, you know, we were in a 40-channel world with cable TV. But most of what you saw on cable TV was reruns.
Right.
In fact, the E channel at that moment was on a nightly basis showing an old Letterman repeat from his NBC late night days. So there was still precious little original programming on TV, especially in late night. And so the idea that CBS was now going to also do a late night program to compete against Johnny Carson, and that David Letterman was going to be hosting, I mean, my God, the world almost stopped on its axis for about an hour there. And it was because this whole generation that had spent 11 years watching him on late night felt a proprietary, and I'm included in that. I mean, my journalism career would not have happened if I hadn't been caught up in the frenzy of Dave's, you know, first year at CBS, and been starved for some sort of source where I could get all of my late night talk show information, which was not readily accessible on what we called back then the net.
Yeah, and in a true story, this happened to me too, with Intertext, which is that was a day when literally there were things that just weren't on the internet. And if you found something you wanted and it wasn't on the internet, you did it. And so you did Late Show News. You just said, okay, I guess nobody has this on the internet. A concept that today, I mean, literally, there is nothing that's not on the internet. But back then, you're like, okay, I'll make it. And so you you created Late Show News, and you know.
We followed, and it's where you could get the guest listings for all the late night talk shows. That was courtesy of my friend Sue Trowbridge, who I think is still doing that on her website.
Wow.
But it's all automated now. But back then, she would take faxes from Charlie Rose. I remember that. You know, she'd get them at the last minute, and it was always a scramble. For those grand old days of limited information. But Dave was really, in that sense, a product more of Johnny Carson's era than anything. And he was this treasure. This national treasure to millions of his fans who felt the insult of Dave's being turned down for the Tonight Show gig and it being given to this schmo, Jay Leno, whose reputation had been just in the sewer until his good friend Dave pulled him up and said, Jay, I know you bombed hosting the Tonight Show for Johnny, but here, come on over and I'll have you do your, you know, what's your beef on my show.
Mm-hmm.
And folks will love you. And Jay was so so grateful for this favor that Dave did him that he began stabbing him in the back.
I mean, it's funny because I remember Jay Leno being a very good late night with David Letterman guest. Very good. And was good rehab for Jay because I had great, you know, respect for Jay Leno when he was the guy who would come on and just kill on Letterman with all of his, you know, and it's very much Jay Leno, but it was, you know, Letterman set him up. He did the Johnny Carson thing, right? Which is like, I'm happy to have you, you know, a comedian that I think
yes.
is talented, shine
Bust
on
me
my
up.
Show. Yeah.
Yep. Absolutely. You know, and the thing we've, speaking of feuds, I mean, that was another great aspect of Letterman's show in the 80s. Here's how I watched late night in those salad days is that I was, first of all, I didn't even watch it the first 2 years he was on the air because I was in high school and college and it just didn't work with my schedule. And we didn't have VCRs, obviously, recording it. So, pardon me. I would come home from studying at the library, and I lived with two other guys, and we had a black and white TV that had no cable. It just had an antenna, and we could pick up Channel 5 in Chicago. So we'd watch Dave. He came on in the Midwest at 11:30, and it was just perfect for us because we're all just zonked out from, in my case, staring at lines of Greek and Latin all night. And he would be on, and I remember distinctly one night he had Marilyn Vos Savant on the show.
Oh, yeah.
She was like an advice columnist or something, mm-hmm. and she came on and just carried on like some genius – You know, hardly gave Dave the time of day, just did everything. I don't know. Did the producers encourage her to do this? I have no idea. But whatever happened, she very quickly started getting on his nerves. And about halfway through the interview, Dave just stops everything and says, "Wait a minute, you're not an expert on anything. You're just putting me on," and just started mocking her. And I just remember that was like, that's not something you do on the show. And within a few months, Crispin Glover showed up and famously swung his platform boot at Dave. And
I can kick.
I can kick, and Dave said, "And I can leave."
I'm going to go check on the top 10. Yeah.
Check on the top 10. Thank God for the top 10. We had that. He could gracefully depart the stage.
Mm-hmm.
But and of course, Oprah Winfrey and Dave did not talk for the better part of 20 years after during one of his remote shows from the Chicago theater, she came on and the crowd was drunk and rowdy, and I'm guessing about 92%. Maybe 98% white, and they let her have it. I mean, they just started razzing her. It was crazy. And I don't think Oprah ever directly addressed it, but I've watched the tape again, and that was a super hostile crowd. And yeah, she didn't have anything to do with Letterman until, I don't know, about 20 years. So that was the other part of Dave's personality. Yeah, he was ironic, and in that sense, he was kind of accessible to people, but in another sense, there was an edge to Dave. And when Bill Carter came out with his book The Late Shift and revealed just how self-loathing Dave was, the gloomy moods that would go on for days and weeks on end, the sessions where he, after a taping, he'd lock himself in his office and people could hear stuff breaking. I mean, that was entirely believable. That that was not a Dave Letterman who was really hiding from us on the air. And I had a talk with Don Olmeyer, the NBC executive, probably best known to people of this podcast as the guy who yanked Norm Macdonald off Weekend Update because he said he wasn't pleasing enough to Middle America or something.
Right.
And I was talking to
because he was making fun of OJ, Don's close personal friend.
He was making fun of Olmeyer's buddy OJ. That's right. I asked him, I said, this was after Leno had taken back the lead in late night ratings from Letterman. And I said, "How did you know it was Jay? I mean, how Dave was dominating his time period." And here's what Olmeyer said. "We had done some polling and we found that the type of person who watches Johnny Carson typically watches four nights a week, which means, you know, at that point they were watching Johnny and at least one guest host, because Johnny never did more than three nights in a week. So the typical Tonight Show viewer watched four nights a week. The typical late night viewer watched two nights a week." And what Olmeyer inferred from this was that Dave's personality was not sufficiently warm and relatable enough to engender nightly viewing. That his viewers, other than his super fans, most viewers, a little Letterman went a long way. And so one of the data points he used in deciding that Jay Leno, who by that point had really gotten himself back in the good graces of the Tonight Show and had learned the routine, would be the better host for the long haul because people would tune into him night after night after night. And in fact, what happened to Dave's ratings in the 24 months after he signed on to CBS kind of bore that out.
Mm-hmm.
He rocketed to number one. That first sweeps he did in November, it was just off the charts. And then he went to LA and Johnny Carson I think the news had already broken that Johnny Carson was going to make an appearance on that night's show. And he had 10 million people watching. 10 million people! You can't get 10 million people to watch a primetime show these days. It was off the charts. And then it started to turn. And there's still no one thing I can point to until about the spring of 1996. He's already lost the lead in the ratings to Leno. And there's some comments about is Dave maybe not got to you know, who's to blame for this? And Dave's already fired Morty as his producer, Robert Bob Morty Morton, who was his longtime producer. And really, I would say oversaw the transition of Dave from this edgy, fringe, late night, goofy guy to a person you could trust with the Tonight Show franchise. I mean, they had a plan and they set an effect and it didn't work. And, Bob did something wrong and he was out on his can after Dave's ratings went down. It was replaced with Rob Burnett. And Burnett's line was, CBS is screwing up the affiliate relations. We lost all these affiliates to Fox. Fox got the NFL. We lost the NFL. Everything's terrible. And it's blame CBS. Blame the affiliates. We're not getting watched in Atlanta. We're not getting watched in Milwaukee. And I did a piece for the New York Observer, which ran on two section fronts. I've never seen something like this. But the New York Observer has two sections, and this story ran on both of them. I got it was really a collaboration. They had my byline, but it was the magic of Jim Windolf, my editor, and the editor of the New York Observer, who was Peter Kaplan, the late, great Peter Kaplan. And the premise of this story was simply that Dave has driven off the viewers. He is solely to blame for this. Stop blaming the affiliates. And what I did was I dissected an episode. And you may recall, I actually sat down and watched an episode with Rob Burnett in their studio. It's the only time I've ever met Letterman. He came in and shook my hand and we stared awkwardly at each other and then he left.
I've had dreams like that. Like literally I've had that dream where it's like, oh, David Letterman. Well... All right.
It is. It's not easy being Dave, and it's not easy being a fan of Dave. Mm. But Burnett and I sat down and watched an episode, and even there were moments that, you know, like Dave had a new producer, new director, his longtime director, Hal Gurney, who had produced Jack Parr, had finally retired. So this guy, Jerry Foley, had taken over. And Jerry had never really done a talk show, and there were these epic tapings that audience members would talk about where Dave would bark at Jerry and segments would be taped over and over. And even on the episode that I had asked Rob Burnett to hand pick that we sat down and watched together, there was evidence of tension between Dave and the booth. So anyway, there was this, it all came to a head in this episode where some sketch involved a David Letterman dummy to be made, a life-size dummy. And I forget what the sketch was, but after the joke was over and he was supposed to move on and do other jokes, he turned around for no reason, took a baseball bat and hit the David Letterman dummy in the head. And he kind of liked it. So he kept hitting it. Of course, Anton Figg, the drummer, goes psh, every time he hits the And at first, the audience laughs, and then not so funny. And this goes on for like half a minute, and it's very awkward television. But Dave, clearly, that self-loathing side could not be contained. It came out. It has never really gone back in. That David Letterman that made a name for himself in the 1980s turned out did not wear so well in the 1990s. And even though I think a lot of people came back to him and viewed him in a different way after his heart surgery, after some of the heartfelt monologues he made, including his post 9/11, you know, this, and we all age. So Dave's audience aged with him. Now, looking back, I can see why NBC gave The Tonight Show to Jay Leno. I really can. Dave had an approach to television. It was a guerrilla approach. There was a take-no-prisoners quality to it. And despite the fact that he always wanted to be the next Johnny Carson, he was just never able to effectively suppress that. It was really part of his humor. It was part of his appeal. And for better or for worse, it's what made him effective. But it always meant that he wasn't going to get the CBS job, that he wasn't going to get the NBC job. And it probably did mean he was a better personality to launch a late-night talk show franchise at another network, which, you know, is a tremendous legacy for him at CBS.
Well, yeah, I mean, CBS had, I mean, they tried Pat Sajak. I mean, CBS had nothing. And people now look at it and you can look through the lens of history and say, well, you know, over the long run, Leno beat Letterman in the ratings. But the fact is, the score before that was Carson everything, CBS zero. And Ted Koppel was in there. And instead, they were competitive. And that was money that CBS was making that it didn't exist. I mean, you couldn't, there was no other late night talk show other than Carson, essentially. I mean, Arsenio came and went, and they tried Joan Rivers, and Chevy Chase was a disaster. But CBS now has this slot. I mean, it's just part of the landscape. So it was great business for CBS. And I wonder what you think of this. I was talking to somebody about this the other week. I wonder if this wasn't all all turned out for the best for David Letterman, too, not having to presumably move to Los Angeles, sit in Johnny Carson's chair. I try to imagine what would have happened to David Letterman in a scenario like that, and I cannot imagine that it would have been a better situation creatively, emotionally, than what he got to do by staying in New York, being the toast of the town, and being, instead of being the un-Carson, he got to be the un-Leno forever.
Yeah, that's a great point. Well, I tell you what, he was Rudy Giuliani's best friend. He was a gift because remember, Giuliani is sworn into office right around this time, and there's this whole talk about reviving Times Square, and Dave is just, you know, what, 10 blocks up from there. Mm-hmm. So he definitely, even after his star on the national stage fades a little and he's eclipsed again by Jay Leno and the ratings, he's still the king of New York. And until Jon Stewart comes along and starts doing the Daily Show. But even by then, you know, Dave has an establishment kind of appeal to him, something he was probably always aiming for. I noticed last night I finally watched an episode of Late Show for the first time in months, and I noticed they're sort of going through the old playbook. They had P-Boy on last night, running through the crowd throwing peas, which was something from the first season of the CBS show, which means that they probably stole it from the last season of the NBC show. They did a lot of that.
He was Green Bean Boy over at NBC. So they.
Oh, is that what?
I don't know. I'm just saying it was.
That's right.
The whole sort of slight change.
The whole intellectual property thing. Yeah. Oh, yes.
It's not the top 10 list. It's the Late Show top 10. What are you talking about? It's totally different. You can't copyright 10. That's just a number.
And of course, there was that great moment that first week on the show where Tom Brokaw strolls onto the stage of the CBS Late Show and informs David Letterman that that last joke he told was the intellectual property of NBC, and walks over to Tony Mendez and grabs the cue card and storms off stage. So, you know, it was a glorious halcyon time for anybody who was a fan of late night television and had spent part of their college years glued to the tube watching Letterman make television history. And, you know, the next 20 years maybe were a little anticlimactic, but everyone from Jon Stewart to Jimmy Kimmel will tell you that they owe their careers to David Letterman. And of course, how can we forget the one guy who absolutely, literally owns his career to David Letterman? And that's Conan O'Brien.
Yeah.
Who doesn't get a chance to cross over from Simpsons writer to late night television performer if it's not for Dave leaving NBC. That was incredible. I mean, that, you know, there CBS is bringing on a guy now to take over Craig Ferguson's slot, but he has tons of
but performance experience.
television yeah. experience compared to Conan, who, I mean, seriously, that was a incredibly audacious move, and we all love Conan, of course, and I still think he's hilarious, and I do watch his show. So, and it's amazing to watch him reinvent himself, but people forget that he totally owes his career to David Letterman. But look, everybody kind of owes their who went afterwards certainly has to tip their hat to Dave, because I think there was genuine questions at the time whether America was ready for more than two late night TV shows at that time, Nightline and The Tonight Show.
Well, I mean, not only the format and are we ready for more, but I mean, you touched on it briefly. I feel like in terms of style and sense of humor, and I assume this is the passage of time, you know, we all get older, that what Letterman did was a reaction to Carson. He was inspired by Carson, but it was also a reaction to Carson. And I feel like when I look at what's out there now, I mean, this is the generation of performers who were influenced by David Letterman. And what we see now is, and they're doing their own thing and they're subverting the formats in their own ways, but I feel like this generation of talk show hosts, Jon Stewart, Conan O'Brien, Jimmy Fallon, Stephen Colbert replacing David Letterman, I feel like these are all people who hold Letterman in that same esteem that Letterman held Carson. These are the people whose comedy sense was touched on at least a little bit, I feel like, by David Letterman. Do you think that's fair?
Yeah, it is. It's a different relationship, though, in that Letterman grew up with three TV channels or five TV channels. Johnny Carson grew up with just a couple TV channels. He grew up mostly with radio. And this generation of performers all grew up with television, and they grew up with lots of television choices. The closest analog would probably be Jimmy Kimmel, who did morning radio before he made his way over to television, just as David Letterman was a weatherman in Indianapolis. But, you know, I think David Letterman will not happen again, in the sense that his sensibilities are really formed around post-war America and the idea that television was this giant glowing presence in the center of the house that everybody gravitated to. And what he did in the 1980s was positively daring. He split that atom. He said, well, actually, there's going to be a late night talk show for mom and dad, and then there's going to be one for the kids. Kids don't have to watch Johnny's monologue anymore. I used to tape Johnny Carson's monologue on a cassette tape recorder and play it back later, because that was considered the kind of the hippest, funniest, most topical comedy anywhere. And now, you know, really going back to the dawn of the internet era, which was a time of great expansion in cable TV offerings, this whole generation is just accustomed to, you know, laughs on demand.
Sure.
And so it, Dave really is like Johnny Carson, in that he goes back to a time when all of this entertainment was considered very, very rare and and special. And so it commanded top dollar, and the entire nation sometimes seemed to be paying attention to what you said. And nowadays, people sit around and pray that they're, you know, a joke that they tell goes viral or a bit on their show gets posted on social media. So I think with Dave going away, you know, it really is kind of the end of an era that started with Steve Allen and went through Jack Parr, Johnny Carson, and David Letterman.
One other question I wanted to ask you, which is to go back in time again. We met on Alt Fan Letterman, I believe. And I just wanted to put that in context. You compiled, before you compiled Late Show News and all that, we met on this Usenet news group, Alt Fan Letterman, the old AF of L, no CIO, just the AF of L. And you compiled the Alt Fan Letterman Frequently Asked Questions file.
Yep. You can still find it out there because
I'm looking at it right now.
I think I updated it about three dozen times between the end of 1992 and the start of Late Show News in 1994. Yeah, that was me trying to, you know, express myself.
Yeah.
And I did it by compiling a yearbook, and then I moved over to doing the newspaper, I think is how I would explain that.
Right.
Now, I was really, you know, talking about late night television, and I can't stress this enough, it was how I found my voice. I mean, I was a graduate student. I was a failed graduate student. I had dropped out of my PhD program. I had a truckload of debt. I was working in a downtown office in Chicago. And my dream, you know, had been to be in journalism, and that hadn't worked out because I wasn't a journalism major, so they wouldn't place me in any internships or give me any recommendations. So then I thought, well, I'll be an academic and I'll write for popular magazines. And that dream, you know, was snuffed out because I hated academia. So to my surprise, this feeling I had accumulated over years and years of watching David Letterman carry on, and this excitement I shared with everybody on watching that first episode of Late Show with David Letterman, August 30th, 1993. Bill Murray and the ghost of Ed Sullivan. Yeah.
Where the hell are the singing cats?
Where the hell are the singing cats? And Mujiburn's Sirajul and soon to meet Rupert at the Hello Deli. All that excitement somehow was able to express itself in a form that allowed me to communicate and connect with other people, which was what I wanted to do all along. And ours was not to question why. Ours was what to do or die. And so I started writing about late night television of all things. And it produced a wonderful career for me in journalism. And now, you know, in long form writing and publishing. But, you know, so when I tell people that I owe my career to David Letterman, I'm not kidding. It was that enthusiasm, that excitement. And I don't know, I look at the people in their 20s and 30s who got a thing for, well, I guess still Conan O'Brien or
Jon Stewart has a huge fan following.
Jon Stewart, yes. Yeah, I mean, he knitted together quite the broad-based audience himself. You know, everyone from, I mean, people in their 60s and people in their teens all seem to love him. But to me, of course, there will never be anything quite as exciting as seeing David Letterman take the stage for the first time at CBS and transform that, you know, rundown old theater into a television shrine again, and entertain America, but also, entertain me.
Didn't it feel like almost like a victory or a graduation or something, that moment of like, well, we knew it all along and now here it is.
We knew it all along. Yes. And what's great, Jason, is that a whole community formed around that. It wasn't just alt fan Letterman, although that's really about the only place you could go to other than CompuServe, I guess, if you wanted to connect with people. But it was in the water cooler talk. It was on the radio. You could talk about it among your dormies at school.
I had a coworker who brought back a K&L's Rock America Mujibur and Sirajul hat signed by Mujibur because he went to New York and he knew I liked David Letterman. That was the time.
It was a wonderful time. And when I tune in to Dave now, I have to say the moment that did it for me last night, because all I watched were the opening few minutes and then I fast forwarded to the end and asleep at the wheel. The moment that did it for me wasn't Dave talking about, telling the umpteenth joke about him going off the air and how glad everyone will be to see him gone and how screwed all of his employees will be because he'll have to go look for work for the first time in 30 years. But the moment that did it for me was when the doors in the back of the theater flew open and P-Boy came out running and throwing things about. Because, not even because it was a really well-executed sketch, but just because that was a thing they did back then. And it had for me still some resonance to the age when it wasn't this enormous and beautifully restored theater, but a crappy little shoebox.
Incredibly tiny.
In 30 Rockefeller Plaza,
Did you ever go in that? Had you ever been in that studio?
Yeah, but I did. I went for Conan's show.
Oh, I took the NBC tour when Letterman was still doing it, and I got to see it, but I didn't get to see a show. And it is staggeringly tiny.
Yeah.
I commend
the producers of Seth Meyers' show and really before that Jimmy Fallon's show, and because they figured out how to make that studio look a lot bigger than it really is.
Is Seth Meyers in that studio? Yeah, I guess he's in that studio and Jimmy Fallon is across the hall, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah, Jimmy Fallon's in the old Live at 5,
yeah,
I think.
Exactly. We all know that from David Letterman walking down the hall. In fact, I wanted to mention
Simmons, Chuck Scarborough.
We talk about thinking about the old days. The Late Show set has off to screen to the right, so, stage left, screen right. Mm-hmm. A pair of double doors. They don't go anywhere, really. They're there because at NBC they had the double doors that they could go out and people could come in. And
all the capers that happened through those double doors. Yeah. You would have to build phony double doors at CBS. And by the way, great credit goes to Sir Howard Stringer, the chairman of CBS, who would then later go on to run Sony, and because he's the guy who eventually persuaded Letterman that it would be worth it.
Yeah,
this tortured soul who just was seeing his dream get away from him, and I think he wanted to just pack up and go to Montana and hang out with the Unabomber, and Sir Howard told him it would all be worth it if he came to CBS and he'd bring the double doors and he could bring the top 10 and he wouldn't have to worry about NBC lawyers. He could just come and do his show. And he did.
You mentioned that moment on that first night. I actually, the indelible moment for me is I was staying at my in-law's house in Orange County, so in L.A., and woke up one morning, and you could look up the date. It's the press conference day, the day after. I woke up one morning not knowing what had gone on because I'd been traveling down to the South, and the front page of the LA Times was sitting on the breakfast table, my in-law's breakfast table, and I was still, the day before, there was still the question of, like, what was Dave going to do? And the front page of the LA Times at the very top is a picture of David Letterman in a suit, holding a cigar, standing in front of a podium with the CBS eye. And I thought
the white CBSI.
And I thought, okay, here we go. And that
the classy black rock CBSI.
Yeah.
All in ivory.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, the iconic picture, and it was a great triumph. It was a great triumph for CBS. It really changed the fortunes of the network. It probably kickstarted late night television. There were a whole slew of late night shows after that, including one that took the place of the Arsenio Hall show, hosted by a young MTV comic named Jon Stewart. And a lot of these shows didn't go anywhere, but the fact that they existed at all meant A, that David Letterman had really opened the floodgates with his tremendous success in late night, and B, that I would have something to do every Tuesday writing late show news.
And now we have five. What is it? I mean, by a rough count, at least five 11:30 comedy shows. 11:30 comedy shows. ABC, NBC, CBS, Comedy Central, TBS. Right, that's five right there.
Well, and Chelsea Handler, is she still doing a show?
They're putting her on Netflix. I think they're putting her on Netflix, so she'll be back.
Yeah. Okay, she'll be back. And then of course there's the weekly roundups with John Oliver and
right. And there's the 12:30 shows, and I mean it's a thing that used to be one thing. It was Johnny Carson for 90 minutes. And occasionally, mm-hmm. Dick Cavett would try, and then he'd go away. Merv Griffin would try, and then he would go away.
Merv would try. Speaking of which, wouldn't it be great if do we know where the 1980s late night set is? Did that thing just get destroyed and
I assume,
thrown in a dumpster?
I assume it did. What I wonder is, and we're completely off the rails now, but I wonder
you mentioned Merv Griffin, so I was thinking the old Seinfeld
right,
episode.
You know, you could. I was thinking about the rights to the shows. I dug up a bunch of old videotapes of old Late Night with David Letterman shows, and figured out how to fix a VCR to work, and then I discovered that they're all on YouTube anyway, so it didn't matter. All these things I saved. It's like eventually no one will know of the Neanderthal man skull from the Museum of Natural History that Dave strapped to a remote control car and broke and made them very angry. And turns out, no. It's on YouTube, but Carson famously, he owned all of his material, and there's a vault with all the Carson stuff, and they're marketing it. And I feel like I want to know: did Carson's ownership revert to NBC? Does NBC own all that? Where is the stuff that's in the Letterman vault? Because I would love that to come out again sometime.
Well, a lot of that's going to stay in the vault at least until David is safely retired not ever planning to come back and has stopped caring. But it was very, very hard to get. I remember that the E deal back in the 90s when E would show Late Night with David Letterman every night, a repeat, which to me was priceless. I mean, those were fantastic. I had a guy who was a late show news reader, and he would tape those things every night, and then he would go back and edit out the parts he didn't like if it was a boring interview or he didn't like the musical guest. And so it wound up being this just thick, 6-hour block of nonstop entertainment mm-hmm. with David Letterman from the 80s. But I later found out he did not sign off on that deal.
NBC
had brokered that deal with E over his objections. And in the end, he did get to choose which episodes would air, and because I think Rick Shecky, his longtime video editor, picked the episodes, and I think his only directions from Dave were, don't embarrass me.
Hmm.
But I think that Dave has never willingly allowed a single rerun of his to air on television. I think I can say that with confidence.
Yeah.
And so that really begs the question, can he ever be persuaded to put together – because it only takes really a few hours. If you look at the Johnny Carson collections that were released mid-2000s, that it's not a lot of hours of television. It really is not. And Dave had a much bigger vault to choose from. Remember, Johnny Carson's – pre-1972 New York-based kinescopes and videotapes
those are
of
wiped.
The Tonight Show were all wiped by NBC. So it was only once he got ownership of the show that he began hoarding the films. He had an entirely different relationship to his archives that Letterman did. Johnny always saw that as a money pile, and now his nephew Jeff Zotzing, who executes his estate, license from the JohnnyCarson.com website licenses video.
Yeah,
I would be very surprised if Dave did that.
Yeah, isn't that David Letterman? He's probably embarrassed by everything he's ever done. and it's a shame, because I'll tell you, I watched – so when I found those videotapes, I ended up on YouTube and I spent a couple of days over 2 or 3 days, I think a weekend, I watched 2 or 3 episodes from that period that are essentially the whole episode. Like, I think I watched the one where Cybill Shepherd comes out in a towel because they had been making fun that they had sent her outfit in advance and they'd hung it on the set. And so then she didn't want to wear it, so she just came out in a towel and instantly regretted it. And that's just a great episode. And I had that thought of, like, you know, it would be fun if you had an internet stream or a channel, that was doing reruns or even a best of set of compilations from that era, because taking out somebody who's plugging some show that didn't go anywhere, it's kind of amazing and fascinating. And I would hate for it to be completely lost to history, because there is some fantastic stuff there. And I don't know whether it'll end up being that Letterman will find in his retirement somebody he trusts to do the project and take a few years and come up with the best set of compilations out there. But boy, I would love to see
something. How old is Harry?
Harry is my son's age, I think. I think Harry's about 10, 9 or 10.
So in about 5 years, he can start going through the old man's tapes and doing his own thing. But the average Dave fan is still probably in his 50s, so there's going to be nostalgia for Dave, and I expect he's going to do exactly what Johnny Carson did, which is disappear.
Yeah, so remember when Carson said farewell, this is a great thing to end on too. When Carson said goodbye, he didn't say goodbye. He said, thank you, and I hope when I come back with something that I think is interesting that you will, you will be interested in it too. That was what he said. His goodbye was not a goodbye. It was, goodbye, and I'll come back with something later. And he never did. I wonder that about Letterman.
He made a cameo. He made an unspoken cameo on Dave's show 2 years later.
Oh, yeah.
And everyone found that very interesting. So he delivered on that.
Yes. But he had no projects, and there had been talk that Carson was going to do a comedy thing or an interview special or like an Oscar, Barbara Walters style Oscar interview thing or all that. Nothing ever came of it. And that's the question with Letterman. I think I'm with you. I think David Letterman's going to walk off, and all we're ever going to see is him popping up in weird places. That said, I wouldn't put it past him to be restless and questioning enough to show up on an internet thing like what Jerry Seinfeld has done, like that is completely absurd and something that he can just do in his own spare time or of his own interest. He shows up and only talks about, auto racing or something like that.
Yeah,
who knows?
It's different now. I mean, I think if Johnny had been around today, he probably would figure out something where he's paired with some young comic in some very informal setting, or Johnny Carson Presents or something like that.
Right.
But that wasn't an option between 1993 and 2005. The opportunities, the shelf space for television entertainment was so small back then that you either go big or get out.
No, it would literally have had to have been like the Carson interview kind of thing. Like I said, like a Barbara Walters kind of thing. Maybe he could have done that, but
there was that series where Tony Mendez, the cue card guy, boy, would just do goofy stuff, and it would get released on the Late Show website as
But I think
Dave would dive bomb. Remember, Dave would photobomb that thing.
I think you're saying this too. I think it's more likely than not that Dave will walk into the sunset and we will essentially never see him again, other than, he'll pop in and wave or say hello or do an interview here and there. But like as a project of his own, I think it's more likely than not that we will never see anything else from him.
I think the good thing about Dave is that he is you know, in the end, he got to do Dave's career is almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? He never thought that he was the equal of Johnny Carson. He always thought that Johnny was always funnier, better interviewer, more urbane, quicker minded, smoother, more gracious, a talk show host than he could ever be. And yet, at the same time, he wanted his job.
Yeah.
And so he has done everything where, if it's possible for him to emulate Johnny, he has done that. And everything else, he has done his own way. And so now he's going to go out in his own way. And it's a different time than 22 years ago when Johnny Carson signed off. And one can never completely disappear in a country that has 1 billion video cameras. Mm-hmm. But he's going to do his very best to emulate his icon in retirement as he has through his career. You know, this is the guy who put Ray Romano on the air, right? He gave Ray Romano a talk show. Johnny Carson, I think the most successful program Johnny Carson ever produced, besides his own show, was David Letterman's.
Right.
And Dave put on
Everybody Loves Raymond.
I mean, that's incredible.
Wow.
So I wouldn't put it past him to do that as well. So what I'm saying is Dave is his own guy. But for the next month or so, we're going to, you know, be nostalgically enjoying the kind of farewell that we haven't seen in a generation since right. Johnny Carson signed off.
Well, you know, and in his own way, this is a thing he would never say. And in his own way, he has matched Johnny Carson, or, you know, in some way beaten Johnny Carson. The idea that somebody would have a show for 30 years was incredible even when Johnny Carson retired. And David Letterman's retiring after 33 years on the air. It's crazy. Yep. And it will never happen again.
Yeah. No. And in part because it doesn't need to happen again. I mean, Jon Stewart feels absolutely no compunction about walking away from The Daily Show after 16 years. He's been doing, if you think about
that, seems like forever.
It does seem like forever. And he's been doing one type of comedy show or another since the early 90s when he did Short Attention Span Theater.
I remember
comedy,
it well. On Comedy Channel. And then Comedy Central. Yeah.
So he's ready for new challenges. Dave was apparently a guy whose personality was, I'm going to do this one thing.
Yeah.
It's the only thing I know how to do. I don't know how to do anything else. I'm just going to do it.
Yeah, sometimes you get the impression that he literally didn't know how to do anything else in life but this.
Now the horizon has got people on it like Jon Stewart and Louis C.K., you know, who can't decide whether he wants to be a stand-up comedian or a Sundance director. And
right.
So he got a cable show where he can do both. Or social commentators like John Oliver and so it's a much more it's just much more fluid because the opportunities to entertain and inform are just much more diverse than they were when Dave was growing up and there weren't even comedy clubs.
Yeah. Well, this has been great. Thank you very much for the time.
It was fun.
I appreciate it.
As I said, it's the only interview I'm doing.
So first question for you is tell me about your discovery of Late Night with David Letterman, because I'm asking everybody that question, sort of like trying to think back to and put yourself in the mind of, you know, back in the 80s and the discovery of this strange thing that was going on late at night.
I must have seen it before this one episode that sticks out in my mind, but realized that this was the 80s. You didn't have, at least in my household, the idea of having a TV in your room was ridiculous. and there was one VCR, and the idea of like commandeering it and making sure that no one is going to eject your blank tape and put in something that they like and then forget to put your blank tape back in when it's time for something recorded, also ridiculous. So, but the episode that really sticks out was one in which the opening shot is of the audience leaving the studio. And just a shot of Letterman in his office saying that, look, it's at the door of his office saying it's just too hot to do a regular show.
Oh, yeah.
So we've sent the audience home. And they did the entire thing legit inside his office where Paul Schaefer had his little Casio keyboard on his lap. Terry Garr was the guest, and he had her, like, basically older brother, little sister berated her into like taking a shower, you know, even though like the shower doors had in his office covered up with towels so she couldn't see anything. She clearly was like not interested in doing that, but was just so just to get him to stop talking about it. And I think I managed to see this because for one like glorious month I actually had a TV in my room. I'd snuck it in because it was a clock radio / TV set that I bought on clearance at the local store. And back easier times. This store had a policy where you could buy anything and return it, no questions asked, for a full cash refund in 30 days. So yes, I bought this. to return it in 30 days so I could have a TV in my room. But this was the one that really made me into a Letterman fan. Just realizing that, my God, this is nothing like anything I had seen on any other show. All kinds of respect for the Carson show, but it was a format that had been really locked in for it must be the early 80s, mid 80s. So this has been like at least two decades, and they don't tamper with that format. The idea that you have a talk show where they would do something as wild as this just locked me into becoming a lifelong Letterman fan.
A recurring theme in my conversations with people is this, which is, it's worth talking about Carson, and you said all respect to Carson. David Letterman idolized Johnny Carson. I remember watching Carson's monologues, and they were great. He was great. And I feel like the difference is, first off, he was a voice of a different generation, and David Letterman's generation idolized Carson, and you could see it, but the difference was, and Letterman was by no means the only person to do that, but what you said is exactly what I keep hearing and keep thinking of myself, which is, we had a format. This is what television, first off, television in general was like, there are rules about how you do television. Mm-hmm. And then there was, what's a talk show? And the what's a talk show is, The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson is a talk show. So what's Late Night with David Letterman? And that moment of delight for, I think, a lot of us was the realization that they were getting away with something. They were breaking the rules of what a show was. You know, Carson did comedy sketches and funny bits and funny interviews with interesting celebrities and all that. But what Letterman was doing was like breaking what a talk show was and going against the rules. And, you know, I think that's what attracted a lot of us to this, is that.
Yeah, exactly. Part of it is just the simple generational ownership. Just like generations of new types of music, there's value to new kinds of music, but then there's also the attraction of, this is ours. This did not exist until we came of age and we started being the audience for a new kind of music. But the other part of it is, just as you say, it's like when you hear a familiar song that's been transposed into another key. Like, you're used to hearing it in the key of B, and now this person has transposed it down to D. And just that twist alone, you just lean in closer and you pay closer attention. Also, the bravery of simply saying that we are not going to give you what you expect. Back then, there was also like all kinds of daytime talk shows that it was just comfort food. It was, we're going to serve you grilled chicken on brown rice. Because you know what grilled chicken on brown rice is. You can order it. It won't make you really, really happy, but you know you won't be disappointed by it. And so Merv Griffin, Mike Douglas, two people that I still don't know which is which, but they had the same show where guest comes out, They talk. They plug the movie. Move down one on the sofa. Another guest comes out, probably a woman, and they have sexy banter between the person on the host and the person on the sofa. And it's not that a lot of that couldn't be entertaining. Some of the prepared shtick that they did was actually very good. And in the case of Carson, as is the case with Letterman right now, it would be silly if this person in middle age were to try to reinvent himself when they've got a machine that works perfectly at this point, and to bolt a rear spoiler and an afterburner onto it, like, and turn it to something that looks like the Batmobile but doesn't run like the Batmobile, that would be very, very embarrassing. But Letterman had the ability and the freedom, along with his producers and his writers, to simply say, here is what people are expecting, so we are going to veer off into a slightly other direction. We're going to make a commentary on how, yes, you're just here to plug the movie, and it's okay for us to acknowledge that I'm reading from a piece of paper in which you have the three stories that you prepared with a producer, and let's see what can happen in the next 3.5 minutes.
Right. What do you think about I don't know if you've got any particular thoughts about the late night era and how did you become a regular viewer? I ended up recording it every night when I was in high school and maybe into college, but TV was problematic in college. But in high school, I recorded it nightly and watched it and saved my favorite bits on the tape and then would move the tape to that point and record future episodes until, you know, I built up a whole like sedimentary layer of comedy bits.
Yeah, I didn't become a regular viewer until I was able to commandeer a VCR, because staying up that late every night was just not going to happen with a full school schedule. Even in college, you have your first semester of freedom. Oh, I can stay up as late as I want and watch TV, and that lasts about 2 weeks before you realize that I don't want to stay up all night and watch TV because I have things to do in the morning and I don't want to sleep until 11 o'clock every morning. But yeah, I think it's been said that the arrival of cheap VCRs was perfectly timed for Letterman's ascendancy because it allowed an entire generation of people, an entire audience that really just cannot feasibly see the show to just time shift it at their own leisure. And the funny thing is, I'm doing the exact same. I did the exact same thing as you did, meaning I would stockpile tapes. I knew that the store that would have these Econo tapes, like a blister pack of like 24 for less than a dollar per cassette or something. And I would fill each cassette on LP mode somewhere in storage. I think I still have like several boxes of just unviewed videotapes. And right now I'm doing the exact same thing. I've got a Mac Mini plugged into the FireWire output of my cable box and a script that's designed to just capture video from the CBS HD channel onto there, because I know that there's going to be a time when I'm going to want to be able to see these shows from start to finish. And I will not be able to get that sort of pleasure from whatever YouTube clips CBS distributes or whatever dupes that people decide to select and put up on the screen, because the monumental, memorable episodes are, of course, great to save. But then I just like the mundane ones as well.
Yeah, I found when I was transferring videotapes the other week, because I've got my old VCR working and figured out how to attach it to my Mac and all of that. That was one of the things. And then I discovered that most of them are on YouTube. yes. Well, oh well. But I took great delight over a course of a few days in watching some episodes from, and they were not completely mundane, but they were essentially, it's the kind of thing where there's a 2-minute thing that they might pull out as a highlight of the best of the year, maybe. But I watched the whole show, and there was a great, it was a nostalgia trip, but it was also just really calming and enjoyable to watch the rhythm of that. Because, you know, a late night talk show is a marathon. You get in a rhythm. It's not it's not really the highlights, right? It's the whole package from monologue to going to the desk to bringing out the guests to the mid show comedy segment to the, you know, guests who are hoping not to get bumped. That's what the show really is, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's wonderful when you have, well, maybe wonderful is the wrong word to use. When you have a show like Warren Zevon's last show,
oh, yeah,
and every second is absolutely electric, and you don't want to turn away even for the commercials. And those that, and Letterman has had a number of those shows, but then it's even the reason why Letterman became Letterman was these routine shows in which they really did build this machine, that they built this office that is all designed towards creating raw material that is put on the desk. And so at 4:30 p.m. at the Ed Sullivan Theater, they can do 1 hour of television. They can produce with whatever materials have been produced over the previous day. And this is a complaint that a lot of people have made about Letterman, is that sometimes, oh my God, he's so grumpy, he's so cranky today. Well, that's what I love about it, that he's a person with genuine emotions. If Letterman is cranky, that's going to come out on the show. There's going to be a cranky show. And I'm not even talking about, oh, isn't it amusing that you can see how tired he is of talking to this person. It really helps you connect to this person, to know that he is a real person with a real range of emotions. Some of the greatest stuff that he's done is that Act Two desk piece, where you know that there are lined up, they're nice blue cards lined up nice and tidy for the comedy bit that has been planned. Sometimes you can even see like a stack of pictures or a stack of albums that are like on the right side of the desk. But he instead wants to talk about fly fishing with his son over the weekend. And that all goes out the window. Just last night or the night before, I saw on one of the writer's blogs from the show, literally about an hour before the show, The staff have been passing around amongst themselves a phone video of Todd the intern who was able to jump across this amazing leap across the entire conference room table. And Letterman was so intrigued by this that spontaneously he just simply decided that, guess what, Act Two, I'm going to do nothing but talk about this video, and we're going to show this video. And that happened not, you know, that wasn't like two days later they decided to make a comedy bit out of it. He just decided to get that video ready for broadcast because I'm going to talk about this. He's a genuine person. That's I'm not belittling anybody who are fans of other hosts, but I just can't be as entertained by people that are, here is step one, step two, step three, step four, and here's the bit that's going to come between step two and three, and here's what I have to say to set up step two. I really do feel as though it's like watching a downhill racer going down that hill, responding to the vagaries of the bumps and the flags that he's passing around. It's about skill, it's about preparation, but in the end, it's how he's going to react on that day to that slope.
One of the things that I always appreciated, I mean, it's you mentioning this made me think of it, is in the late night years, he had this, I don't even know what to call it. It was like a tick, but what was brilliant about it is that, again, you're deconstructing what the show is, and you could see that it was David Letterman making judgments about what he wanted to do. And it happened in a couple places. At the desk, he would have like a stack of, you know, small town news or whatever. And he would literally pick them up and go, nope, and throw them out. And, yep. And just like, he is throwing away jokes that he doesn't like at the desk. And then, of course, I think the apotheosis of this is during the monologue, one of his tics that I loved the most, to this day, I will say it occasionally, is he would squint at the camera or just off from the camera where the cue cards were. And he would go, I don't think so, Kevin. To Kevin K, the cue card guy. And he was like, he was saying on the show, we're going to skip that joke. It's no good. Let's move on to the next joke. And that blew my mind, because it's like, I'm watching a professional be, by some standards, unprofessional. But I found it more like, I'm watching this guy and we're all together kind of careening down the slopes with this guy, and he's making his judgments about, no, I'm not going to do that. Let's just keep on moving on. And that was fascinating in so many different ways. And you're right. I think he still got that. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the central things I like about the show is it's always been about, let's not pretend that show business is anything but a business, that a job that we're doing. And the way that the sense that he is coming to his desk job at night, and here's the staff that also works on this show every single day, that it's okay from this. I have memories of that too, of him flipping through, like he's clearly pulling the eject handle on the bit, and he's flipping through these cards looking for one solid joke to go out on. And sometimes he didn't find it. He would just simply look at one, put it down, flip, 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 look at another one, nod, put it down. And then, like, pause for 3 seconds. Okay, we're going to go commercial. We'll be back with Kevin Pollak.
Yep. Yep, yep. We're done. We're done. Play the music. We're done.
Just like Carson used to be able to do that too. There are monologues in which he is clearly getting nothing from the audience. Mm-hmm. The jokes aren't helping him. The audience isn't helping him. And you can say, okay, I'm in the bunker right now. I've got about 8 shots of ammo left, but damn it, I'm gonna get out of this bunker alive, and I'm gonna make sure everybody knows that I'm fighting for my life out here. And the fact that they can acknowledge that and make that into comedy, that's why Carson is Carson and Letterman is Letterman.
So the move to CBS, I want to talk about. And any memories you've got of that too. I think it's funny. First off, I'll throw my theory at you. I've thrown this at a couple other people already. I almost feel like everybody was better off with Dave not getting the Tonight Show job. I know that he wanted it and it was his dream job, but I think about Letterman, who had been positioning himself in the run-up to this as the, you know, respectable enough. I think they had actually tightened the reins on the show a little bit to be like, we're respectable, we could do the Tonight Show. I feel like he would have had to, or at least would have tried to, do Johnny's show, and he would have been in L.A., and he would have had the scrutiny of NBC on him. And instead, he got to go to CBS. He got to stay in New York. He got to be, you know, a key part of the, you know, revival of Times Square and Broadway, and loved by the, you know, Giuliani and all of that. And be the underdog and be embittered and against, you know, have an enemy to rail against. I don't know whether you buy this or not, but that's my theory, is that I think it would have actually been worse for all of us if he had gotten that job, even though, of course, at the time, I absolutely wanted him and not Jay Leno to get that job.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've really had to go back on my thinking about that. I'm sure that I blogged stuff that I kind of regret now. Because it's absolutely true that's the best solution that could have possibly happened for him. Not only is he going to a place where he is eagerly welcomed, he's not just one of two people that NBC doesn't seem to care which one gets the job. Because remember that at the very, very last moment, they actually offered to take the job away from Leno and give it to Letterman.
Yeah.
And the Bill Carter's book, Late Shift, really does a great job of telling this story about how painful it was for him to finally be offered formally the Tonight Show. And every single person, including Johnny Carson, was saying, if I were you, I would walk.
That's the moment where you're like, do you want the jokers who would do something like this? Do you want to work for those guys?
Yeah. But then, you know, if I were offered a terrible job with great responsibility at Apple, shaping a product that I really, really care about, but the terms were horrible, it would be so hard for me to say, nope, I will not be the person who's in charge of defining the future of the iPad. Versus being able to do effectively what I want someplace else. It's a hard thing to grow up with this fantasy and let go of that fantasy.
Right.
When he moved to CBS, he was going to an organization that desperately wanted him and was really eager to make it very clear how much they wanted him. More than that, they were giving him ownership of the show. So at no point could the network say, you're doing it this way, we say we want you to do it that way. They can't fire him and replace him. They can cancel the show, but that's certainly something that they certainly understood at the time. It's the retaining the New York identity, not having any of the baggage of the Tonight Show. That's just ultimate freedom. And I think that Conan had the exact same benefit later on when he moved to TBS. And certainly moving from a network to basic cable seemed like a step down. But once again, he owns the show. He owns 11 to midnight from TBS, and he can do whatever he wants. So he could do the show he wants to do. So, yeah, I mean, Leno was the perfect choice for the Tonight Show. Jimmy Fallon, also the perfect choice for the Tonight Show, because this is the comfort food part of the Tonight Show. After Carson, it was never going to be the Tonight Show after that. Jerry Seinfeld had a very, very smart thing to say, and I think in Bill Carter's second book, about the second NBC late night crisis, saying that what none of us understood was that when Carson left the Tonight Show, he took the Tonight Show with him.
Yeah.
And so this stopped becoming an iconic show, and it started becoming the deliverer of ratings and the the golden arches that people would think of as a familiar and, okay, this is a safe place to stop from 11:30 to 12:30. To do really innovative stuff, you're going to have to go to Comedy Central. You're going to have to go to CBS. You're even going to have to go to TBS, because it's not going to happen between 11:30 and 12:30 at NBC.
Yeah, and the when we talked at the time about, like, what's the scenario if Letterman gets the Tonight Show, I think everybody was thinking, well, what happens is you get the Tonight Show and then you're there for 30 years. And what Conan O'Brien went through shows, nope. They could, I mean, and that was the point at that time, is like, the guys who jerked you around and offered it to Leno and then we're going to take it away from them, those are the people you're going to then be working for, and you're going to sign a contract and maybe you'll get a lot of money out of it, but that is a bad... That is a bad group of people to work for, because they could do stuff like what happened to Conan O'Brien. So my other question for you about this CBS move is, what did that feel like as a fan of David Letterman? Because for me, it felt almost like graduation day. Like, in hindsight, I think, like, I watched the show a lot less after those first few years at CBS. I sort of, my viewing trailed off to almost nothing. But on that day, and when that first show aired, I felt like, you know, these are my people. We all made it. We watched that weird show in the 80s, and now here we are, and it's the big time. Did you think anything like that, or was it just like, oh, he got what he wanted. He's on at 11:30.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. We have no right to feel any sense of ownership about that, but it did feel great to know that Letterman did not have to inherit his dad's show. He was able to create his own business, and his own business being incredibly successful in and of itself. I think that I thought that was a great validation that Leno or Jimmy Fallon, they really do need to have that name brand on their show. They need to have that legacy in order to have a successful show. They need to have the power of that brand behind them. Whereas Letterman is his own brand. You know, he brings his own staff. He brings his own sensibility as a nominal editor-in-chief of his entire show. He takes his own sensibility with him. And yes, it did feel like terrific validation. And I never stopped watching Letterman. And I'm actually starting not worried about what happens when he goes away, but realizing that this has been his show has been a constant in my entire life. And it's always a little bit sad when a constant goes away, even if it's, you know, that day that, you know, you sell your mom and dad's house because they're both gone. And now you're no longer going to be going back to this address that has been, you know, a big part of your life, all of your life. Or even if it's just that they stop making a brand of soda that you really like. It's there, you attach so much to these touchstones of your life that when it suddenly goes away, you don't feel like you're lost. But you realize that, oh, man, that's going to be, I'm going to miss that. I'm going to really miss that a lot.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I as somebody who does not watch regularly, I still am feeling, obviously, I'm having this conversation with people like you, I still am feeling that loss, that this is a mile, for me, it's a milestone less about what I'm losing today and more of the recognition that it's this end of this era that I treasure, and this person who has influenced me tremendously. And that's actually another thing I wanted to mention, to ask you about. Would you say that the kind of comedy that was being done on late night in the 80s influenced your sensibilities in any way?
I would say so. Largely in the sense that it's okay to take a step back from whatever that routine is and try to understand what the purpose of that routine is. Because sometimes you realize that you're just going through, you realize that it just goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And you don't get to the result just by repeating the same steps that have been established for 5, 10, 15, 20 years. I will say that as a teenager, it was maybe a bad time to be introduced to the comedy of being sarcastic and saying, oh, man, isn't this lame? Take a look at how lame this is. Let's all make fun of how lame this thing is, realizing that there was a deeper sensibility underneath that. But if you're like 12 years old, 13 years old, you spend, oh, man, you know, Coca-Cola, that's so lame. And, oh, man, Casablanca, what a lame. It's old, so it's lame. It's you hopefully break free of that. But I think that the longer lesson is that, you know, don't just take the first bus that comes along. Think a little bit about what used to make this whole template work, and maybe there should be a brand new template. Maybe there's a new maybe it'll instruct you on the best way to go in the future.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely find myself similar. You got it. That's about it. It's like maybe not the best time in life to have that worldview, but I feel like my approach to appreciating comedy and my approach to when I attempt comedy is so informed by that ironic approach that I can't stop it. That's just how it is. And I feel like we're surrounded by people. Part of this generational thing and part of the emotion of like watching David Letterman retire is knowing that Carson was perceived as being this guy who'd been around for a million years, and yet the next generation totally idolized him. And I feel like this is, look at where we've gotten to. Letterman has been around. He's the old guy who's been around for a billion years, and the next generation of talk show hosts all idolize him. So now he has taken that role, and you look at, you know, Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert and Jimmy Fallon and Jimmy Kimmel and Conan O'Brien, and you know the list goes on of people who all say, well, Letterman, huge influence, if not like the influence in what they're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been said very correctly that a lot of the things that he brought to late night had been done by Steve Allen before. The idea of we're going to go on the street, we're even going to be a suit of tea bags and dunked into a giant tank and make iced tea for everybody. Yes, Steve Allen did that. But the fact remains, though, that it's like looking at the first Macintosh. It's like looking at the first iPhone. You can see here is what everything looked like before this one, before Letterman had his show. And then here's what everything looked like after he had his first season of Late Night with David Letterman. And then you can't say that in 1983, 1984, people were suddenly discovering Steve Allen and aping him. It really was Letterman who brought this into a modern sensibility. And I'm sure there are a lot of other things about going on in society at that time that sort of begged for a skeptical, jaundiced eye on things that were big in the 70s. This was the Reagan era. This was the Thatcher era. And so you're sort of promoting the idea of let's just go with the assumption that if the previous generation thought this was the coolest thing ever, maybe we can just sort of step back from it and tear it apart a little bit. But again, everything changed after Letterman, and it wasn't because of a delayed fuse on the Steve Allen Tonight Show.
Right. I'm trying to think if there's anything else that I need to ask you. Is there anything else that you would like to talk about on this subject that I haven't prompted you about?
Yeah, definitely. A couple of things. One of which being that there's that reassuring routine. All my professional working life, and even before, like I became a full-time writer and was holding down a day job. Letterman, the appearance of Letterman always represented just a big flag in the sand of my day. Back when I used to work until about 3 or 4 in the morning, I would take a break for Letterman. And then when I come back from Letterman, I realize that, okay, I've got about 2 hours left. What do I want to do in this remaining 2 hours? And it really was like seeing the goalposts at the end of the day. Right now, it's more like, do I want to finish this before Letterman, or do I want to watch Letterman and then wrap things up so I can be in bed by 2 and get started in the morning? It's really, he is like the sun rising and the sun setting. It really is. It has an effect upon how I mark out my day. It's going to be very, very hard to suddenly not have that sunrise and that sunset. And the other thing being that people have often been complaining about how he seems to be phoning it in over the past 5 years and even longer than that. And I'm actually kind of pleased that he seems to have found a comfortable rhythm for himself in the show. He gave an interview to Alec Baldwin on his podcast, and he's talking very about how his attitude changed, not necessarily because of having a kid, but certainly sometime after having a kid, that he realized that we've been doing the show for many, many years. I have, over those years, we have writers and producers that have been working on this show for almost as long as I have. I trust that they will do their work correctly. And so I don't have to really tear myself apart every single day about every single detail. It's running so well right now that I can show up at 11 a.m., take a look at what's been written, make some selections, have a couple of meetings, and then pretty much be ready to go at 4:30. And it pleases me greatly that he was able to make it to this end zone where he's now in his late 60s. He doesn't look like he's burned out. It doesn't look like this job has destroyed him. And it looks like he's spending his last two years with the show in a sense of calm and happiness and peace that I don't think that I think this sort of stuff certainly eluded Jack Parr. And it certainly seems to elude some other hosts. I like Conan O'Brien, but sometimes you can really see his anger and his frustration that this is not what I when we were planning out this show tonight, I had plans for it coming out much, much differently than this. And I'm not happy with how things are coming. And that was definitely the Dave of, you know, the late 80s, early 90s, certainly when he was fighting NBC. I'm very, very pleased to see him ending in a place where his blood pressure is low, his heart rate is low. He seems to be able to lean back and enjoy what he's doing. And if it means that we don't see the suit of Alka-Seltzer on a 66-year-old man, that's perfectly fine by me.
Yeah, this is, you know, I think it would not. This is the way of the world. This is the way of life, right? He's becoming an old man. He's been doing this a long time. I think it would be unbecoming of him to try and pretend to be young. Exactly. We mentioned that about Carson earlier, and I was going to mention the Dana Carvey Carsenio sketch on Saturday Night Live, which was lacerating. And yet at the same time, the point was sort of like, what's Carson going to do? Try to be Arsenio? Because that's not going to happen. That's going to be ridiculous. And I feel like that with Letterman, he's doing the show that he should be doing at his age. And also, and let me know if you agree with this, I feel like he can't pretend to be the poor put upon underdog anymore. Exactly. You know what? He's the elder statesman. He won. He's been doing the show for 33 years. You know, at some point it is a complete put on to act like you're the rebel because he's the man.
Yeah, exactly. I actually wrote a blog post about this a year ago or two years ago that it's absolutely ridiculous for him to try to be hip because he is the establishment at this point. You can't pretend that he doesn't have tens of millions of dollars. You can't pretend that he is not both culturally and economically one of the most successful people who has ever done that job. I like the fact that they have he and his staff have gently sort of shifted his role. When he started off in that chair, he was the person who, I'm going to have the remote microphone, I'm going to try to deliver a basket of fruit to NBC executives, and I'm going to batter through the barricades. I know they're going to throw me out, but I'm going to get great shots of them being jerks and me being calm and me trying to just do something nice like deliver this basket of fruit. Now he's in exactly the opposite role. A lot of the humor that they do is he's Uncle Grandpa. They're on the middle of the stage, and younger staffers come up, and he has no clue what's going on. You know, and they can actually even like be berating him because he is the establishment figure, and that's absolutely appropriate for him to be doing this kind of comedy at this stage in his life. Because HBO is now running that new documentary about Frank Sinatra. And they have to cover the sadness of the 1970s where he's doing, you know, sing us a song. You're the piano man. Sing us a song tonight. And he's dancing in a variety show with a fifth dimension wearing a spangly Nehru jacket. And you're like, oh, honey, no. It's kind of ridiculous to want to have the exact same role in popular culture in your 60s that you had when you're in your 30s. It is so much more satisfying to realize that people I'm delivering something that people count on every single day. It's not that I'm bringing something fresh and new every single night. It's that I'm delivering something that's absolutely reliable and that is the bedrock of simple craftsmanship and reliability. I kind of disparagingly talked about, oh, well, the grilled chicken breast on the brown rice. But then there is the styling of a Rolex watch that if Rolex decided to, oh well, we're losing a lot of sales to Casio G-Shocks, let's make a lot of like LCD plastic, like a lot of knobby things on it. No, there's something classic about how refined and practiced and knowledgeable their designers are about the product that they make, that if they were to deviate from that, it would make that product look very, very cheap and very, very tacky. And Letterman is that level of refinement. He can do more by simply stepping out and saying four words than a lot of other late night comedians can do with material that they spend an entire week developing and rehearsing.
Hmm. Anything else you want to say before we go? I'm happy, but
yeah. Yeah, I'm gonna miss the hell out of him. I'm hoping that we do continue to see him after he retires from the show. I've been reading Mark Evanier's blog. He's always a great go-to for information about what the actual business of talk shows and show business. And recently he's been writing about how when Johnny Carson spoke in his last show and in interviews that, well, I'm going to be doing something else. It's just not going to be at NBC at 11:30. He actually did expect that he would find something that would interest him. But he just simply never felt as though he actually found it. Hopefully there's more opportunities for Letterman in 2015 than there were for Carson in the early 90s. Now it's very, very possible for him to actually do a web show that is like a talk show, a one-on-one discussion for a half hour that happens six episodes that are released twice a year. Because when he was on Seinfeld's Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee, there's the just that quick, easy, natural wit and that wry observation and that self-deprecation without cutting himself and to watch him bleed that reminds me of everything that I love about Letterman. And so if he were to simply say six times a year, I'm going to find people that I like, that I really enjoy talking to, including some of the best guests we've ever had, but also just people that kind of strike my fancy, that would delight me to no end. It would be a great shame if he were to stop entertaining because he's so good at it. Although I guess the final thing to say is that he has certainly earned a long and long and wonderful rest. And unlike Carson, he has a wife that he's been married to for a long, long time. And he's a child that seems to be materially involved in. He has not spent time distancing himself from loved ones. So maybe he just wants his new career to be fly fishing with his son and his wife.
Yeah, I was talking to Aaron Barnhart about this, and I said, I kind of feel like it's still more than 50% chance that we never see any substantial work from him ever again. And he certainly earned that. But the difference between when Carson retired and now is exactly what you said, which is he could very easily do a web series about whatever interests him and with no overhead. And I could see him doing that. And I could see him embracing that, just like what Jerry Seinfeld did with his series, something that is whatever kind of Dave wants to do that he thinks is going to be fun. Like, he's still got the bug a little bit, but he wants to do it, you know, and not have to worry about, complex commitments or anything like that.
And he would have complete control. He wouldn't have to like kowtow to whatever the demands of another network would be. And another important factor is that there's barely a trace of the stigma that used to exist about not being on a network anymore. Because some of the top talents that we have today are doing things for Netflix, and they're doing things just for under this thing called Crackle, for heaven's sakes. I know it's owned by Sony, but who knows what Crackle is. So I think that if there was any bug inside him that said, well, look, I can't do a show on TBS. I can't go from network to basic cable. I think that in this last phase of his life, he could certainly do that. Jay Leno has one of the I have so much more love for Jay Leno now that he's that guy that does these great car videos on YouTube than I had when he was on this show on NBC that I just had no use for.
Yeah, the car thing actually is the thing that I keep coming back to about, you know, that's something he loves. Mm-hmm. And that wouldn't surprise me at all if there was something involving racing or something like that that he did just because he doesn't care. And he's like, I love this. I'm going to make a thing. I don't care who watches it. And I could see that happening too. So I don't place the odds a whole lot above 50% that we'll never see anything major from him again because the internet has changed it. With Carson, I don't even know, you know, what he would have had to do to bring a project back. I told Aaron the best I could come up with was like a Barbara Walters interview kind of thing where he picked some interesting people and did interviews with them or something. And, you know, but boy, then suddenly it's a big production thing that you have to get through and you're retired. And do you really want to do that? With web stuff, you know, Letterman could do, he could do a weekly talk show on the internet with, you know, without wearing pants. And, you know, that the world is different now. But again, I think I agree with you. He's earned just going off into the sunset and spending time with his kid if he wants to do that. But I do wonder if he'll take advantage of the world we live in today he also is mischievous enough, you know, that it would not surprise me if he does come back, if it's in some completely unexpected, bizarre way involving internet video. Yeah, and I would love that.
you know, they've started to, if you look at the Letterman channel on YouTube, they've started posting videos from the audience warm-up, and anybody who says that he's lost interest in the show, watch these. He still every single night comes up and warms up the audience personally, and that's like a 10-minute, 15-minute conversation with the audience. And seeing him on a stage with a corded microphone in his hand, simply responding to people from the audience and adding his own stories, really made me think that wouldn't it be so satisfying if he simply decided that six nights a year, I'm just going to do a date. If there's a 2,000 or 3,000 seat theater in like Boston, New York, Philadelphia, San Francisco, I'm just going to do six dates a year. And it's not going to be a major tour, but it's going to be, let me go out there and just keep doing that stuff. Cause it reminded me of exactly how good he is. What a great sharp wit he is and how agile he is just playing with a microphone and an audience.
Yeah.
And actually, now that I think about it, one other thing I really wanted to say that didn't really occur to me because we're so having so much fun talking about Dave, I'm going to miss that band.
Oh yeah,
I cannot. That's the other great thing about the show posting stuff to YouTube. They will play. Here is the entire set that band played during the 5 minutes between commercials, and you just see this band that can do anything. I mean, they've been playing together every night. In some cases, since 1983, the core of the band, Willie and Paul, have been together since I think the very beginning. The core four members have been there since the middle of the first show, and that's a level of tightness that no band is going to get. And then when you look at everything this band has been called upon to play, that absolute, you know, throw your guts out onto the stage, rock and roll, all the way down to the quietest folk, the quiet classical music. I can't remember which opera singer it was. Not only to say, I think it was sang a top 10 list, and each one was a takeoff on a classic opera aria, and it was the band playing this opera music, not you know, rock and roll versions of, you know, of Puccini, but playing actual like orchestral arrangements of this thing. Not a problem. We'll be back in funkadelic mode like at the next commercial, but right now we have to be an operatic orchestra, and we can definitely do that. I hope that they tour. I hope that they do a couple of dates a year. I hope they release some albums, because I've got that YouTube downloader app on my MacBook, and the stuff that I absolutely grab is all of these musical performances, because they are just amazing.
Well, thank you. This is great. Great material. I think it's going to be good. I've never done an episode like this before, but I wanted it to be sort of special, and I wanted to have it be a little more personal. So I thought the series of individual interviews and my own personal kind of thoughts to woven together. We'll see. It's got a lot of extra work too, but I felt like I wanted to do it.
It'll be a little This American Life sort of version of Incomparable.
That's sort of what I was hoping for.
Worth the work, though, I'm sure.
I wanted to do something special, too. That's the thing. I really did want to do something special because this is meaningful for me. So thank you for being a part of it.
Yeah. I mean, I'm very, very pleased to have been asked to participate in this, because, you know, this is – I don't think that we will – there are other hosts that are going to retire at some point in the next 10, 20 years. I don't think that there will be the same sense of an era passing ever again. now that Letterman is retiring.
No, I mean, we said that about Carson, and then Letterman did 33 years, sort of even longer than Carson. But it seems hard to believe in this landscape that we're going to see anybody with an audience anything approaching this size be doing the same show for essentially for 30 years, because it's just that world doesn't work like that anymore.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you.
Oh, thanks, Jason.
Pleasure as always.
As always, I guess I'll see you next week.
So I'm talking to a few people about Letterman because I want to put together a thing that's going to be not like the regular podcast thing. I'm going to try to do one of those things where I edit some interviews and some thoughts myself and do a little special thing. I don't know, because I wanted to do something special.
Seems like a great idea.
So hopefully I will not blow it, but I wanted to try it and you know, push myself creatively a little bit too. But I wanted to do something special for Letterman because it's just like it's a milestone for me. This is a big deal.
Yeah, it does. I feel like... I don't know. I watched last night. I've been off for a while. I don't know. Have you been watching Letterman like the last few years?
No.
I have not.
Two or three a year maybe.
Yeah. I'm like, probably a little more than that, depending on guests.
Yeah, like, it's all about the guests, right?
Every once in a while now, a guest will pop up and I'll be like, oh, I got to see, you know, got to see Bill Murray or something like that. But I haven't been watching regularly. And it makes me feel like, I don't feel like he's lost it, but I watched last night and he showed, I guess they're going to do this now through the end of the run. He had like a bit from 1997 and it was so good.
Huh?
Oh.
That's good. Let's start at the beginning. How did you discover Letterman?
I'll tell you what, I have very vivid memories of this. So I was born in 1973. Mm-hmm. And at some point in the 80s, there was a show hosted on NBC, and it was hosted by Ed McMahon and Dick Clark. It was like Dick Clark and Ed McMahon's Bloopers and Practical Jokes.
Yep.
And for whatever reason, it passed the test in my household. I have a sister who's 2 years younger than me, and my mom. We three would watch TV together at night because my dad worked third shift. So, and we all liked it. And on this show, they would occasionally have bits from Late Night with David Letterman. They would just like some of the remote bits that he did. They would just show them to fill space on the Dick Clark, Ed McMahon show, which I think in hindsight was like a crazy show, like just like filler, like before there was reality TV, before something like America's Home Funniest Home Videos or Tosh or something like that, where they're showing user submitted footage. It was just like NBC had like an hour to fill and Dick Clark and Ed McMahon were happy to do it. And so they would fill it with Letterman bits sometimes, not every week, but every once in a while they'd have a bit from the Letterman show that would make sense at 8 o'clock. And they were the best things in my opinion. And I remember one of them very specifically was – And part of what made it great was that Letterman himself wasn't anywhere near as famous. He had his own 12:30 talk show, but he could go out in public and not be mobbed. And it was Letterman and a camera crew going around Manhattan to find diners. And every one of these places had a sign in the window that said, best coffee in New York. And it was just Letterman going in with a camera guy and telling them, hey, you know, there's a place two doors down the street that says best coffee in New York. And people would either like – the reactions were all across the board. Like some people, like there'd be like an old Greek guy who ran the place and he'd be like, no, my coffee is the best. Like he would be insistent. Like it wasn't just that he put the sign up just, you know, like instead of just saying hot coffee, there was just a thing. And Letterman made it hilarious. And that is – it made me want to – desperately made me want to watch his 12:30 show, which as like an 11 to 12-year-old was sort of a stretch.
Yeah. I mean I have memories of watching – my mom graduated from high school in, I'm going to say, 57 maybe – and so she had her 25th, let me see if I'm doing the math. Yeah, it's her 25th reunion was like in 82, 83. So it was right when Letterman had come on. I think it was 83. And we went to in Dubois, Pennsylvania, we went to her high school reunion. And my parents were out, you know, in the hotel till all hours of the night. And I ended up in the strange hotel room with the TV on and this strange show was on. And I was 11, right, or 12. And I didn't get it, but I was like, who is this strange man and what is he doing here? And it was like 2 years later that I have no idea how it hooked me, but it hooked me to the point where I had access to a VCR at that point, and I just set the VCR to record at 12:30 at night. Because I was very rarely up that late. And in high school I actually got into the habit of watching it in the morning before school. I'd just get up early to watch David Letterman from the night before, like Tuesday through Friday, right? Because he wasn't even on Friday night. They had music videos on Friday night.
I remember the first time I actually watched late night with the actual show, and it was a similar type of situation where I, you know, still wasn't allowed to stay up that late at home. I was on a field trip to Washington, D.C. with, you know, was a suburb of Pennsylvania. So it was like I think we had two overnights, or maybe it was just one overnight. I don't know. But we at least had like one or two nights in a hotel. And I was in sixth grade, so I must have been like 12, around 12. And, you know, like typical sixth graders, we were up, we were wired, you know, wide awake. And it got to be 12:30. I think we were watching HBO. I actually specifically remember the HBO movie we watched. It was a Chuck Norris Vietnam movie.
Wow.
What was that called? Prisoner of War or something? Or Missing in Action? Was Missing in Action?
That could be it.
I think it was Missing in Action. It was an HBO movie. It was rated R. So it felt like we were already getting away with something. Mm-hmm. You know, a bunch of sixth grade boys in a hotel room. And then the movie was over, and I realized, holy shit, it's 12:30. I can watch the Letterman show, and I've always wanted to watch it. And the show had already started. It must have been about 10 minutes in. My friends had never even heard of it. They didn't even know what it was. They were, you know, more or less of the opinion that we should look for another Chuck Norris movie. Because we've got HBO, right? We're in this hotel room with HBO. So I flipped to NBC. And I remember exactly what was on. It was a monkey cam. They had a camera strapped to a monkey, and he was running around the studio. And the footage was first person perspective from this monkey that they had set loose in the studio. And I thought it was amazing. I was like, this is the type of stuff I thought would be on this show. And my friends were like, what the hell is this, Gruber? We're turning this off. And I'm like, no. And I thought it was, and they only let me have like 3 or 4 minutes of it. And then they were like, this makes no sense. We're turning it off. We're switching. But it was Monkey Cam.
That was a classic. I remember that. You know, the true story there is they got like an actual monkey and put the camera on it, and the camera was way too big, and the monkey like fell over and couldn't move, and they had to get like a chimp or something. They had to get a much larger primate that was capable of carrying the wireless camera. So they had to do it like 2 or 3 times before they got it to work right.
I didn't get to see the setup for the bit. I didn't get to see how long it went. All I saw was the monkey cam footage.
It's got
to
leave an impression, right? It's like, oh my God, this show is brilliant like this all the time.
Yeah, exactly. And there was something about it, and those the bits that I saw on the Dick Clark, Ed McMahon show, the fact that the first time I ever actually got to tune into it live, it was a monkey cam. It just resonated with me, where it's like, this stuff doesn't make sense, but it doesn't make sense in a way that I completely get. I get it.
Right.
I get that this is stupid, but I get exactly why it's stupid.
So this is something in all these interviews I'm doing that keeps coming up. And I think there's something to this that, like, as kids, we all internalized like what the rules were of television. And like Carson, like I knew enough about Johnny Carson. I had seen enough about The Tonight Show that I was like, and other TV shows, like there are rules, right? There's rules of TV, and this is how it works. And people come out and they do some jokes, and then they have a conversation, and there are rules. And then Letterman, you see it and you're like, wait a second, doesn't he know the rules? He's getting away with something here. Somebody's going to stop him, right? And that seemed to be, for me, that was what made me so enthralled by it, is like, I thought I knew all the rules, and then this guy shows up and he's not following the rules at all.
Yeah, I feel like, and it's a weird, it's a weird sounding analogy, but to me it makes a lot of sense. Is to me, Letterman is a lot like Quentin Tarantino, in a way that Letterman, to me, clearly internalized all those rules of TV, like, and he understood them specifically as TV. Like, he was just young enough that he grew up with TV being the pervasive, ubiquitous influence in American culture that it has been for, you know, at least since the 50s. Whereas those rules of TV and like the rules that like the Tonight Show personified predate TV. Like the rules for a variety show are sort of the same as the rules for any kind of stage show, like a, you know, the vaudeville or anything like that.
Right.
It's like a theater production, right? The Tonight Show is like it wouldn't be that different if it wasn't being televised and it was just a show that would a celebrity show that was put on for the 300 people in the studio audience. Whereas what Letterman did was he understood all those rules and could just play with dance within the lines. And to me, that's like what Tarantino does with all of his genre movies, where he's internalized all of these movies. And he makes his movies within the cracks of those lines.
Oh, and he had a genuine – Tarantino has a genuine love for film history and for those films. And Letterman had a – you know, and has a genuine love for Carson, right? He's not Carson. He's not going to ever be right. Carson. He doesn't really want to be Carson. And yet you could not find a figure that he more looked up to and respected than Carson. It was like that. That's the root of it. But then right. I'm going to do my own thing now. And it doesn't say anything bad about what you did. I'm just going to take that and now do a new thing.
And broadcasting in general, I think Dave is always at his best with any kind of broadcaster. You know, he had a tremendous rapport with Tom Brokaw over the years. And there's a guy who's doing something very different. You know, he's you know, America's newsman. But Letterman understands that, like any kind of broadcasting. And you know, just look at some of the great guests that Letterman's had over the years. A lot of them are just guys who – or men and women who are just great broadcasters. Regis, Barbara Walters –
Connie Chung for a while.
Connie Chung, yeah, terrific example, right, where they're just people who he understands that, and the rapport that they would have with each other was tremendous. And to me, it was based on the fact that they were, you know, both sides of the desk were people who are TV broadcasters. And it just, there's a certain, whether it's serious, as serious as the nightly news or as goofy as a 12:30 comedy talk show, there's a certain, I don't know, we're doing the same thing.
Yeah. No, I agree. I mean, he would always talk about being on the broadcast and being a, I mean, I think he viewed his role as being a broadcaster, I never read Letterman as being a stand-up comedian, even though he did stand-up comedy. And the fact that he was a weatherman in Indiana, and, you know, I think he went into comedy in LA because he felt like that was his route into the business. But he always felt to me like, you know, obviously a very funny person who defined comedy for, I mean, how I look at comedy in so many ways. But as a broadcaster wanting to do a program, like that's what he wanted to do, not just let me tell some jokes and can I find a way to tell some more jokes. It was, you know, that broadcasting ethos, I guess, I always got that from him.
Yeah. And I would say like the opposite of that would be Jimmy Fallon. And not to put Jimmy Fallon, not to say whether I like him or don't like him. I think he's okay. He just isn't my cup of tea. But he's truly like a performer. He likes to sing. He likes to dance.
Right.
His Tonight Show, his role as host of Tonight Show is very much of, you know, the type of guy who does. And again, he's probably not really a stand-up comedian. I know he's done it, but like a performer.
He's like sketch comedy. And yeah, you're right. Absolutely. He's a performer.
You know, and
in that sense, a more, yeah, yeah. I think for it's the difference between like I'm going to do a bunch of bits and characters and things versus I'm going to hold down a desk. If that makes any sense, like Letterman, yeah. I felt like he was holding down the desk, like he was like an anchor man in a way. Whereas Fallon feels like he's, you know, that's not the, it's a comedy show that has a desk as a prop, but it's not quite the same.
Right, it's definitely a different mindset.
You talk about the Tonight Show, and I wanted to mention this when I'm doing these interviews. There's like the little milestones: Letterman not getting the Tonight Show, and Leno getting the Tonight Show. At the time, I felt was this just grievous insult that Letterman had earned it, that he deserved it. And you know, I would argue that he probably did deserve it. But in hindsight, I look back now and I think one. You know, Leno gave them what they wanted, which was a long run with good ratings of not trying to offend anybody and doing it exactly as they expected he would. And Letterman didn't have to move to LA, wasn't in Johnny Carson's shadow, didn't try to like temper his show to live up to what 11:30 on NBC was supposed to be. Got to, you know, he got to stay in New York, do stuff in New York, and be aggrieved by the fact that he didn't get the Tonight Show. So in hindsight, I look back and I think, I think this is the best thing that could have happened to any of them, was that that he didn't get the Tonight Show and he got to stay in New York and do the Late Show.
Yeah, and I think he's on the record, and who knows how it would have worked out in the long run, but he's on the record, I know, as having said that if he had gotten the Tonight Show, which he definitely wanted, his plan was definitely to, you know, keep it where it was, go out to Burbank, and more or less do the Tonight Show.
Yeah.
As it was known, like he would just be taking over and doing it, you know, and he had guest hosted before, and, you know, Jay Leno had guest. I mean, you know, more or less Jay Leno just turned his weekly guest hosting gig into what he did. And, you know, Letterman planned to do the same. It was like an institution that he just felt you couldn't mess with.
Right. And so I just look at that and think, you know, I don't know. Who knows how it would have gone, like you said. Although what happened to Conan O'Brien makes me think that it could have gone really badly. And the fact is, I believe Bill Carter reported that they, at the last minute, they like turned and offered to dump Leno and give it to Letterman. And at that point, everybody was saying, you don't want to work with these guys. But I think that's like, okay, who are these yahoos that are offering me this job now? But in the end, like, you know, New York fits Letterman. Being mad at NBC always fit Letterman, so why not keep it going? And so in the end, you know, him going to CBS didn't feel like anything but victory to certainly to me. I don't know how you feel about it, but it was like, look, this crazy stuff that we all talked about in the mid-80s, look what happened now. Now he's made the big time, and it's sort of on his own terms, even though he got driven out of NBC, or he didn't get the big job. You know, he chose to leave 12:30 and go to CBS to take what was his.
Yeah, and in hindsight, I think it makes his career seem more accomplished, because he was the first person to successfully create a rival to The Tonight Show. And I know that over the, what I guess must have been at least 20 years where he and Leno were head-to-head, or
15 at least, yeah.
Well, when did he switch? Was it 93?
I think so.
So, you know, it's probably at least 20
years.
Yeah,
20 years.
And I know that for most of that time, Leno had the ratings crown. I mean, pretty consistently. And early on, Letterman was actually ahead in the ratings.
First couple of years.
But it's complicated by various facts. I mean, it's just the way that, you know, any kind of number like that doesn't tell you the whole story. I mean, it certainly helped, but I mean, I think Letterman had a higher salary, and I think his show might have made more money.
And it certainly went from nothing. Like you said, he created it. CBS had nothing, and then they had this franchise.
Right. And the other big thing was that a lot of those years, NBC, like in the 90s, the NBC was by far and away the ratings leader in prime time, and it's, you know, it predates TiVo and stuff like that. And lead-ins matter, you know, that people were watching Friends and then they watched whatever was on at 10 and then they watched the local NBC news and they just watched 4 straight hours of NBC that went right into the Tonight Show. So I'm not making excuses for it. I'm not saying that that's the only reason that Leno had the crown. But he certainly, without any question, turned CBS's 11:30 spot from nothing into something
right. That
was a complete rival to the Tonight Show.
And he got to do what Johnny did. He got to program his, you know, 12:30. You know, and he was the king. He was, you know, CBS just handed him the keys and said, thanks, Dave. And
right.
Was that ever going to happen at NBC? I doubt it.
Yeah, it just seems like he never had a good relationship at NBC. You know, and he was, his production company did Everybody Loves Raymond, mm-hmm. which was a huge hit. I mean, it's, you know, one of the biggest sitcoms of the era.
Yeah, people miss that. When I talked to Aaron Barnhart about this, this is one of the things he brought up, is what does Letterman do now? And it's like, well, you know, he could do nothing, like Johnny Carson, who thought he would come back and never found something he wanted to do. He could do a web series or something like that. We live in an era where if Letterman wanted to just do something like what Jerry Seinfeld's doing or whatever, he could totally just do that and like not make a big deal out of it and just be, I want to do this now. All of those things are possible, but I forget what I was going with this. Now I've lost track. Aaron made some fascinating points about like the difference in time and the fact that Letterman now, like Jay Leno too. He's just got like a car show on cable now, and it sort of doesn't matter. It's like you could do whatever you want when you leave the air. You've got this kind of freedom that Carson kind of couldn't do, but Letterman could do whatever. This is what it was. It was about Everybody Loves Raymond. It's like he could produce stuff too. I mean, right. he has this production company. He knows smart and funny people. Johnny Carson never produced a 10-year running hit sitcom that threw off, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars.
I always thought I'm shocked to 0% that you've spoken to Aaron Barnhart. I thought back in the day, like when he was writing, what was his newsletter
called?
Late Show News, which was fantastic. It was absolutely, it was the pre-web internet. It was it was an actual email newsletter. I think it probably went to newsgroups too, but it was great. It was phenomenal. But I thought one of his key observations from back in the day, I don't know if he talked to you about it, but he was never, at least initially, was never a fan of the theater that Letterman,
Ed Sullivan Theater, yeah.
The Ed Sullivan Theater. That being a big Broadway theater made Dave play big, to play to that audience, and in a way that the tiny little studio that Late Night was in Rockefeller Center when he was on NBC, let him play small. And there's a definite difference in Dave's on-air persona, both shows. I mean, he talks about it as being one show, and in a sense it is. It's like two halves to the show, though. There's the half that was when it was at 12:30 at NBC in a tiny little studio, and then there's the modern half starting in 93 where it's the flagship 11:30 CBS show in a big theater. And he definitely, his personality is the same, but his persona is different because you have to play to the room.
Have you been in either of those? Have you seen it? Did you see a show at 30 Rock, and did you see something at the Ed Sullivan Theater?
No, I've never been to either.
Oh, wow.
I'm sad to say.
I can tell you. So I went on the, I was like number 20 in line and for standbys the one time that I went to see him at NBC, and so I didn't get in, but I did take the tour earlier in that day and got to see the, you know, Late Night with David Letterman studio, which I think back to now is one of these, like, that's amazing that I even was in that room. It was impossibly small, and Conan O'Brien used that same studio.
Right.
It looked, the way they shot it, it looked much more expensive. It was a closet. I mean, it was tiny. You could play racquetball in there. And then the Ed Sullivan Theater, I got to sit up in the balcony, and I was at the back. And yeah, it's a huge Broadway theater. They could not be more different. Aaron and I didn't talk about that, but we did mention that on Late Show, even to this day, off to the right of the screen, stage left, but to our right, there's those metal double doors.
Yeah,
they don't go anywhere. They go like side stage or whatever. Why do they exist? And the answer is because they had them at NBC. And it was like funny. A good thing to have people come in and out of for bits.
Right.
And so they built it. And they didn't need to build that. It's like a stage. I mean, it goes into the wings or something, but it doesn't go to a hallway or anything. It's like a part of the set they built to replicate what they had at NBC, because it was a really great thing to go down the hall, and there were the elevators and the green room and all of that stuff, and they wanted to replicate some of that. So I think there's some truth to the fact that, you know, suddenly you're on stage in a big theater and you're at 11:30. You're like on a literally and figuratively on a big stage, right? That you're going to change.
Yeah. In hindsight, I actually think it was the right move. And I think it was kind of genius, and because I feel like the wrong thing would have been to keep doing the same thing. Like, it had to change, and so therefore embrace it. And I think Hal Gurney was actually a big part of choosing to do the show in the Ed Sullivan Theater. And the Ed Sullivan Theater was really run down at the time, apparently. Like, at CBS, had kept it, but nothing had gone on there.
Yeah, it was for like, I think like 10 years at least, it had been like nothing was there. It was just rotting.
I think even when it had been used like in the early 80s, it was really sort of past its prime. And it was Hal Gurney, you know, Dave's longtime director, who was like, no, we can make this work. You know, this is what we need. And I think it was, in hindsight, I think it's sad because what they had and the vibe they had in the tiny little studio and Late Night was so great. But it's, you know, everything in life, you have to move on. You know, you can't be a child forever. You know, no matter how great your childhood is, you have to grow up, right? And even when you're a parent, eventually your kids grow up and the show had to grow up. And I think embracing doing something as big as possible, it makes it more interesting. Like in everything in life, I feel like it's the smallest stuff or the biggest stuff that's always the most interesting. So going from a tiny little studio to about as big of a theater as is plausible to do a nightly show is probably the right way to go. And I think the other thing that Hal Gurney did, or at least helped with, was to maintain this continuity of it felt like the same show, right? And just like what you said, with them putting like pointless, seemingly needless double doors stage right, it just helped with the familiarity. If you knew the old show, the new show definitely felt bigger and different, but it felt familiar enough.
So same geography, right?
Right.
Even if the audience was now four times the size or more, it was the same geography from watching on TV. You know what the curtains are over to the left and the door is right to the right and the desk is at the center and the band's off.
Right. I don't remember. I was way too young to remember Johnny Carson's show in New York, but I can only presume at least, you know, in my lifetime, he had some. I don't think he moved studios, but they definitely redesigned sometimes. But there was a certain geography that had to stay the same, right? Like, you know, with the Carson show, you know, if a comedian came out, it was Johnny would look right, at least on TV.
Yeah, to
right?
his left. They looked to his left. It was the right. reverse of the Letterman geography.
Right. And there just had to be you had to be curtains, right? You had to come out mm-hmm. from curtains on the Tonight Show.
Right. And Letterman had his like sliding doors and stuff at that point instead of curtains. Aaron was talking to me about how like Carson made some very specific demands. Like he went back to he had this long battle. It's in that American Masters about Carson, right? He had this long battle. I want to go from 90 minutes to 60 minutes and all that. And I want to produce the show that comes on after me. That was part of the deal. And so now he's built his empire because he was very much an empire builder and was worried about Lorne Michaels and other people taking over, you know, some power with NBC. So he gets the show and he says, okay, we're going to do Letterman as a show. But the constraints that they had to work under, which I think led to some brilliance, were amazing, right? Because they were told, like, you all of these things, you can't be like Carson. So I would not be surprised if it was like, we don't want you doing curtains. We, you know, do it the other direction with where you introduce guests. You can't have a long monologue. You can't have topical jokes. You can't book the same guests in a long period of time. There was a huge list because right. Carson didn't want this other show from this younger comedian host guy to resemble his show. And so it didn't. And that became the new convention for Letterman.
Right. I remember, I don't know what the specific contract said, but I know that there was this, I think it was a time length on the monologue.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it was like four jokes, I think is what Aaron said.
See, I thought that the contract was just time, that it was like it has to be under 4 minutes or something like that.
But it wasn't even a contract because it was his show. So he had the guy, I think it was a Dave Tebbett. He had like a guy who was in the credits, it was always for Carson Productions.
Right.
And he was the guy who would be like, here are what the rules are.
Yeah.
Here's what Johnny says you can do.
And the monologue, Dave just embraced it. Like
yeah.
the monologue on, I think people who are only familiar with the modern Letterman show, the Late Show, if they went back and watched some of the 80s ones with us, like me and you would be dying and mm-hmm. just crying, laughing. And they would be like, wait a minute, that was the monologue? Like three stupid jokes, one of them which didn't make any sense at all. And then Dave would just turn and show his ass to America and walk to his desk. Like three quick jokes and be out. And it was just sort of like the way Dave's attitude was at the time made it seem as though we're legally obligated to have a monologue, but so here's your stupid monologue. Joke one, joke two, joke three. Okay, now
it was an anti monologue, right? Let's get to the comedy, which is going to be over the desk. This monologue is just something I was talking to Andy Anako about today about this, which was one of the things I really loved about Letterman of that era, especially was it was like you were watching him fly the plane. That one of the funny things that again broke the rules was whether he was at the desk with like Small Town News or something, or whether he was looking at the cue cards. One of my catchphrases that I use to this day from that era of Letterman is he would squint at the camera during the monologue and he'd be like, "Yeah, I don't think so, Kevin." He was talking to the cue card guy, Kevin Kay, and he was literally in front of us saying, that joke's no good. Let's just skip that joke. And he'd get to the desk and he'd look at a joke on a card and be like, no. And he'd throw it. And that was one of the ways he would throw those cards through the fake windows and make that sound. It was like, he's literally like judging the material that's been written for him on the air. How crazy is that? But that's right. what he did.
Or especially like if a bit was going south, you know, like small town news mm-hmm. or one, you know, or crazy ads or something like that. And he would just start flipping through. He'd be like, I know there's at least one more good one in here. Yep, here it is. Here it is.
And we're then
he
would just
throw. Right. He would just throw the rest away. But he would know, he did know enough that there's one somewhere back here. Okay, yeah, this one. And then we'll just dump it.
Well, I wish it's unclear to me who owns, you know, or if he and NBC co-own the rights to those old shows. And I know he's so self-critical that he probably never wants anybody to see him again. But I found a few old shows on YouTube, just like complete shows, and they're great. And in fact, I think the rhythm, it's funny, you know, all the edited highlight packages in the world will be very funny stuff. Like that, the Taco Bell, you know, she's already gone, Chief. We use that line all the time, too.
I just linked to that, didn't I? I know it just came up.
Oh, that may be. Yeah. I love that stuff. But you know what? All the edited highlight packages in the world, as great as they are, they miss the rhythm of doing that show. Like day in, day out, week in, week out, where you've got a whole, the show has a shape, and you got the monologue and the comedy and the guest and the mid-show comedy bit, and then the guest who might or might not make it on.
Even the commercial bumpers, the way that they always had those still photos.
Yeah.
And somewhere in the still photo would be the Late Night with David Letterman logo. And it might just be like, a nightstand next to a bed, and there's a card, or it's the counter at a deli or something like that. Just random still photo from somewhere in New York, you know, and Late Night with David Letterman somewhere there. And it just had like a rhythm to it. Just no other show I knew of used still photos like that.
Yeah, it was. You know, Saturday Night Live did some interesting things with their bumpers too. But you're right. The Letterman, the art direction of that opening. I can recount the original opening too, which was the gritty back when New York was really a shithole.
Right.
You know that was what the opening was. It was like steam coming out of vents, and it was late night in New York City. This is what you got. And then they would have those. Usually they weren't always distressed, but a lot of them, it was like, I remember like half peeled off bumper stickers or something that said Late Night with David Letterman on and stuff
exactly.
like that.
Yeah. Midtown was, I wasn't there. I don't think I'd been to New York until I was a little bit older, or at least I think some point in the Giuliani era.
My first time in New York was when I took that tour. It was February 93 was the first time I was there. And I saw the studio. So it was right at the end there.
Familiar enough with it that Midtown was a mess at the time.
Yeah, it was not in the 80s. Yeah, it was scary.
To me, the pinnacle of Late Night with David Letterman was, I think it was 1989 when he came back during the writer's strike.
Oh, man.
That to me was I'm not putting him down that everything's, you know, it's a long time ago, but it was just everything that I loved about Letterman, everything I loved about his show was just in those no writer shows. And even Dave, and it was, did Johnny come back too?
Johnny did come back too and had to write his own jokes.
So there was a long, really long protracted writer's strike with the Writers Guild of America. And so all sorts of stuff went off the rails in 1989. But long story short, no writing meant no shows, and they were all in reruns. And Letterman went stir crazy and was like, screw it, I'm going to do a show without writers. And even he couldn't write his own stuff, technically.
My understanding was there was a writer-performer clause so that if you were the performer, you could write your very own material, which is why Carson could write monologue jokes that he told. Letterman could write jokes that he told. But they couldn't write for other people. And so, you know, that was the limit, is they could make up their own jokes, but they couldn't write sketches, and they couldn't, you know, and they couldn't have people writing for them. And when they came back, because there's a legendary story of like during the writer's strike of Carson, people like looking in Carson's office, and he was sitting in there in like 100-degree day, and he's got his sleeves rolled up, and he's just writing jokes on pieces of paper. He's writing his own material, which he had never done, hadn't done for, you know, 20 years.
Right.
And Letterman, yeah, so he did his bits, and the show just became that much more absurd, right? And they had Hal Gurney's Network Time Killers. And
which is just the best. It was just – they would just – and Hal Gurney, he was such a great presence on the show because he was so deadpan. And he was – if you didn't know, he was truly like – deserves like a authorship credit for the show. Like he really – you know, can't say he was as big a part of it as Dave, but you know, he really was like Dave's father figure, co-creator of the show.
It's Meryl Marco, David Letterman, and Hal Gurney, I feel like, right, are the three parents of this show. Yeah.
And Dave loved him, but on air acted, he would even like mispronounce his name. He acted as though he was just like some stooge that NBC had set up in the booth. He'd be like Hal Gertner.
Yep. Gurney
and
Dave.
He'd be like Gurney. And just how Gurney's network time killers would just be like, it's just the dumbest stuff imaginable. Just, you know, here's a guy who, you know, bangs a trash can.
Yeah, here's Kenny Rogers impersonator.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So got to fill the time. Yeah, and you know, Gurney was a like a golden age TV director. He directed the Tonight Show with Jack Parr.
Yeah.
So he knew what the form was. He totally knew what the format was.
I thought that those shows, they really, what they effectively did, the show was always half Inside Out and half meta and half winking about it. You know, there was this whole meta-ness to it. And with the during the writer's strike, they just turned it completely Inside Out. And I think to Carson's credit, Carson's shows, as I recall, of that same era during the writer's strike, remarkably felt like just regular Tonight shows that single-handedly, without a writer's writing staff, Johnny Carson was able to run a regular episode, you know, three episodes at the Tonight Show every week, which is crazy, right?
Yeah.
Considering that they usually have a staff of like a dozen comedy writers who are like all the comedy writers in the country are dying to get on the staff of, like, super competitive, super prestigious. Like, that's how you know your career is out off the ground in comedy, is you're, you know, writing for Johnny Carson show. He did it all by himself, and it was remarkable how it felt like a normal show. Whereas Dave's shows during the writer's strike were so clearly not, you know, and it, whatever self-deprecation he had on a normal night, it was just up to 11.
Well, I mean, it was an opportunity. They were absurd, but to my mind, I agree with you that that was one of the high points, if not the high point of Letterman's run. But how they reacted, those two guys reacted to the writer's strike was also very telling. Like, Johnny was like, I'll write a few monologue jokes, we'll do some interviews and musical guests, and we'll have a show. And Letterman's response was, this is absurd, let's make it absurd. And like, we will tear the show even further apart. And so Carson's show runs with, you know, fewer jokes, and maybe they're a little less funny. And Letterman's show comes apart, like purposefully comes apart.
I think that's the first one. The first one, I just Googled it, and the first one from DuckDuckGo is Hal Gurney's Network Time Killers. Kenny Rogers impersonator.
Mm-hmm.
Mark Hines.
Yeah. Why? Who knows why?
Yeah,
he was available. Yeah. Yeah, that was great stuff. Well, we're over a half an hour.
Okay.
And I think I nailed it. I mean, that was the – I was looking for the beginning and the middle and the end. I mean, if you – my last question would probably just be, you know, if you have any other thoughts about the end here and what that means. Because it's given me that moment of thought of like Carson looked up – or Letterman looked up to Carson, and today's TV hosts really look up to Letterman. And it feels like it's come full circle where somebody watching today is going to say, you know, Letterman, he's just that old guy who's been there forever. I really like – you know, name of host here. But all those hosts will say, Letterman, he's the guy. It's like we've come all the way around where David Letterman, by not being Johnny Carson, as it turns out, he couldn't be. He's hosted a show for 33 years, and he essentially is the revered figure to this whole other generation, which makes me feel a little bit old, but also appreciative because I like David Letterman.
Yeah, I think it's funny to me because the one other late night person who I like the most is Jon Stewart.
Yeah. That's what I'm watching every day, honestly, is The Daily Show.
Yeah, me too. And it's just funny to me. And, you know, again, he's been doing that for a long time. But it's just funny to me that a guy who's a generation behind Letterman is already stepping down from his show.
Yeah, I feel like Jon Stewart has other things he wants to do, right?
Yeah.
And something that Aaron Barnhart said to me is I'm not sure Dave has something else he wants to do. This is what David Letterman always wanted. Jon Stewart was a stand-up comedian. He really was a stand-up comedian, and he had all these other interests, and he went off and directed that movie. It's like Jon Stewart seems to be a guy who's got lots of things and found something he's really good at, but he's like, you know, I got other things I'd like to do with my life. David Letterman, I've never gotten the sense that he wanted to do anything except host a late-night talk show.
Yeah, he was. I think like Carson, he was just born to do it.
Yeah,
and in a way that, like, to me, no, they're the two singular people like that. Like, and say what you want about Leno, but Leno's a great comedian. He's never stopped working. You know, doing just stand up comedy in Vegas and other places, tours. You know, Jimmy Fallon, his show is a hit. He could do anything. He could stop it and go into, you know, do movies. He could, you know, there's all sorts of stuff Jimmy Fallon could do. And that's the same for just about all of them, you know, and not to put any of them down. It just doesn't seem like anybody else was a natural born. They should have a show every day.
Well, I'm starting to think that Stephen Colbert is the closest thing, and he's going to be the one replacing him.
And that's to me, the wild thing about that is that we don't know. We don't know because he did the whole Colbert thing in a character. I think there's a good chance. I always thought that Jon Stewart would be the one to take over. And part of it is just the simple politics that, you know, the parent company is the same for Comedy Central and CBS. I think. I don't know.
It used to be. I'm not sure whether they still are or not because they had that weird
thing. Yeah.
It's the same reason Star Trek is owned by two different companies now.
There's some kind of corporate symbiosis.
Yes.
Stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he's a New Yorker, and I just felt like that he could keep going. You know, he would be the right type. But clear, like you said, I don't think he doesn't want to. There's other things he wants to do.
Yeah.
Colbert, maybe. He could. Maybe. I do think there's the other thing about Letterman is that he say what you want about Carson and like the rules he put Letterman under, but he wanted to always be the top. He was, you know, defensive enough and insecure enough that he would do little things to make sure nobody supplanted him. But he let Gary Shandling and Jay Leno and Joan Rivers and David Letterman host his show. Weekly, every week, there were these talented people. And, you know, the only one he ever turned against was Joan Rivers when she decided to go head to head against him. But he gave them this platform. You know, he gave this younger generation of would be successors this platform. And Letterman never did that for anybody. Like, he never picked a 12:30 host who was in any way a plausible replacement for himself.
Right. That's true.
None of the people who've hosted the 12:30 show after Letterman could ever have been considered for the Letterman spot. And he never did guest hosts. And I always wondered, you know, I know that was one of Aaron Barnhart's things over the years, that Letterman works too hard, that five shows a week is too many. And part of what made Carson seem fresh for so long was that he only did three shows a week for 40 weeks a year.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, but you're right. I think Letterman having that control. Part of me thinks that he knows what kind of show works at 12:30. And he's like, look, I've got the opportunity. I want to find somebody who's good at 12:30, not somebody who's going to wait around for 11:30 because I don't want to go anywhere. So I have a chance on Craig Kilborn or Craig Ferguson or even Tom Snyder. It's like, that's a guy who could do 12:30. Let's put him in there at 12:30. But you're right. He was, you know, Carson didn't have any fear. Maybe because Carson just figured I'm the only guy who can do 11:30. So, you know, I'm here. And I think Letterman maybe was more like, I don't want somebody who's doing our show. I want somebody who's doing something really different in his own way. The same thing that Carson told Letterman, except the difference was, Craig Ferguson was never going to do that show. Whereas Letterman would have done Johnny Carson's show if he had been allowed to.
Yeah. I just wonder the 12:30 thing. I don't know. And I feel like with the Tom Snyder show, Letterman clearly had very different ideas for what could be at 12:30. Again, going back to that respect for just pure broadcasters,
right?
Which is exactly what Tom Snyder was. If there's anything I wish that I could have seen, maybe them try differently would maybe starting like 10 years ago, let somebody guest host every Monday, right there from the Ed Sullivan Theater. Mm-hmm. And then have Letterman only do four shows a week.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Other than when he had his heart surgery, right? He just never, a guest host was not a thing that.
No, I think that was the only time they ever did. Yeah. I think that was the only time they ever had guest hosts.
Yeah. Well, without David Letterman, I would not have my appropriate appreciation of Regis Philbin. So there you go. Thank you, Regis.
I do. I'm right there with you, though. Like, I just, it's hard for me to even put into words how empty it's, even though I don't watch it that often anymore, it just feels right to me that David Letterman has a show every day. Like, I'm sure it's exactly how, like, the people, like, my parents' generation felt when Carson stepped down.
I mean, the sun rises in the east, it sets in the west, and then Johnny Carson's on at 11:30, right? This is how we know the passage of time.
Well, I loved Carson, you know, and I loved his show, too. I liked spending 2 hours every night watching both shows. Loved them both. Mm. But it always felt to me I was too young, and you know, it's the lack of wisdom, the foolishness of youth. You think, I thought, well, of course he's going to retire. He's kind of old, right? I mean, yeah. Great. You know, not that I was sick of his show, but I thought, of course, you know, it doesn't seem like. Whereas, you know, and Letterman's, you know, probably right around the same age. So I'm sure somebody who's in their 20s now is going to think the same thing. Well, of course Letterman's retiring. He's, you know, he's kind of old.
He's an old man. He's been doing it 30 years.
Right. Whereas I can't remember. You know, I was 10 or 11 when Letterman got on the air. So, I mean, anywhere even vaguely close to having an adult mind and awareness of American culture, Letterman's been on.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it doesn't feel like America without him.
Yeah, I'm with you there. Even though I don't watch him every day, that just such a presence. He's a presence in my life every day because I've internalized so much from the years of watching him. And so, like I said, I think part of the story is the passage of time and this handing to a new generation, and the David Letterman becoming what we perceive Johnny Carson being when we were kids, and now he's that guy. But he's our guy. How can he be that guy now? Right. It's, you know, that's raising. I mean, my daughter is almost at the age that I was when I discovered Late Night with David Letterman. And, you know, she's going to discover somebody on YouTube.
Yeah. No, totally. Exactly. It's so true. It's definitely going to be on YouTube.
Yeah.
I'll say this. I'll close with this. There's two moments from 9/11 that I remember vividly on TV. I remember the morning of when it was happening live, and I was sleeping, of course, because it was early on the East Coast. My wife called me. She was at the gym, and she's like, "You got to put the TV on. You know, they're attacking New York." I was like, "What?" And I remember I watched ABC, and Peter Jennings was still alive, and I was watching Peter Jennings when the second, or when I guess it was when the first tower collapsed, because they thought it was just a fire, and nobody had really thought this through as to where it was going to go. And I just remember the telecast vividly. It was just astounding. And then the other thing I remember very specifically was the first Letterman episode afterwards. I don't know if it was a week. I don't know if it was 2 weeks. I forget exactly when. But within a week or two, it came back on. Do you remember this?
Yeah.
Do you remember
how it opened?
No music. It was just silence. And then Dave at his desk. And he killed it. Right? It was just amazing. And it really, it just gave me this sense like, you know what? We're going to be all right.
You know, I remember that. I also remember vividly when he went on after the space shuttle Challenger. And it was the same thing. You know, he came out to, they did the opening theme and all that. But when he came out, he just addressed it. He's like, this has been a really, really bad day. And I remember that really vividly. Like, just, you know, call it like it is. This is a terrible day, and, you know, we're watching you. And he said, like, we're not trying to be disrespectful here. Everybody's had a really difficult day. And I remember that and appreciated that. And then when 9/11, after 9/11 happened and he came back, I had that same feeling. That and the Conan O'Brien did a show, I think, within a day of that, of Letterman coming back. And it was the same kind of feeling. Yeah. And I, you know, those hosts in New York having that, and there's something to that about watching somebody we know who's there, and it's like a collective moment that is hard to find. You know, unless you go down somewhere where there's a candlelight vigil or something like that, it's a shared experience in a way that, you know, it's like a. Thousands of years ago, we would have all gathered together in front of the cave or something, right?
But we don't have that now. There'd be a leader. You know, we've evolved to look towards somebody, you know, in a time of crisis like that. And no matter how independently minded you might be, you know, as an adult in a stressful situation like that, you want to turn to somebody. And that's the weird, crazy thing that the TV, the invention of TV, and now the internet has enabled, is the possibility that instead of being the leader of 20 people in a tribe, that, you know, millions of people are turning to you.
Right.
And, you know, there have been a lot of people like that on TV. I mean, Cronkite, you mm-hmm. know, people before Cronkite, mostly news people, though. And to me, Letterman, achieve that same sort of stature.
Yeah, oh, I agree. And being that was that moment too, where you realize that when most Americans think of who's in New York, honestly, David Letterman is in New York, right? That was, at that time, you know, he was the one who was there. I mean, they're the news people and all that, but yet when I thought of New York, I thought of David Letterman's New York. I thought about the Hello Deli and, you know, all that kind of stuff, right? Because he would go out on the street and talk to actual New Yorkers, and so that was a powerful moment. And, you know, Giuliani coming there and saying, you know, thank you for being back here. You know, the city needs to continue living was super powerful. So
yeah, it totally did. Yeah, and Letterman, you're true. You're exactly right, though. But Letterman's show is so of New York in a way that the newscasts aren't. Like you know, I bet a lot of people who watch those shows every night don't even know what city they're from.
Sure,
they could be anywhere.
Yeah, unless they got the it's like the ABC morning show has got Times Square behind them. Say, see, we're here. But yeah,
because Koppel used to go from Washington, and who knew that? I mean,
right.
You know,
he was there. The same backdrop, or like the same blue backdrop with a picture of the Capitol instead.
Right.
You always talk about being a music critic before you were a TV critic. Where did you discover Letterman? Were you like a latecomer who was like, oh, I guess I need to watch talk shows and things now? Or did you discover him in his heyday in the 80s?
Oh, yeah. I discovered him when he had a show in the daytime.
Oh, you were one of the morning show people. All right. Mm-hmm. The show that was inappropriate for morning.
Yeah, it was random. And it was like Edwin Newman was one of the, it was so weird back then. And I discovered that. In those days. And then he was like, I don't know. I mean, I'm a little more jaded now because I've been a TV critic for so long and there's been so many hosts there. But at the time when I wasn't and I was just a TV fan, I was like, okay, this guy, to me, I felt like I was watching the revolution, man. This guy, I thought this guy was great. I didn't know all the influences he had, but I did know, and now of course I know, but how refreshing and funny and goofy he was and that you had to watch. That was great.
It seems to me that what drew a lot of people to Letterman was the fact that he was undermining the actual like premise of what television was supposed to be. That, you know, Carson was funny, but Carson had the rules. And there was a monologue, and there was witty banter and things like that. And with Letterman, you felt like all of a sudden it was like he cracked the code or something. He's like, you know, how did they let him get away with this? That's not how you do a talk show. He was like tearing apart what the format of the show was. And that was what I know delighted me when I first saw it, was like, wow, he's breaking the rules here.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that the first time I saw the monkey cam, I was like, oh my God, I love this show. You know, like, this is great. Or just like the idea that a grown man says, you know what? What if we dropped a bunch of stuff off a building? Let's just do it. Let's just shoot that.
Let's put that on television.
Yeah. And before, I mean, you learned that there was stuff in the past, but he really did become the master of the taped segment. And I think more so than anybody, I think he's, you know, if he wasn't the original idea for it, he certainly was the person who honed it and who mastered it. And of course, now that's all we think about with late night is the like the video bits that they're taped and that are not a guest sitting behind a desk or even like a Carson moment at the desk with Karnak or something like that. It's all Letterman's taped bits. Everybody does those now. So that and to be there when that happened was great. Or also to be there, to be honest with you, he didn't suffer fools, and that was really new on late night. That's the thing. For him to give you a look like you're just being the idiot now, right? Like there's a bunch, right? There are some where he joked around. He would make people embarrassed if they did something embarrassed in their life. He was like, okay, you're not gonna actually walk onto my show and not pretend you didn't make this book where, you know, you're naked in it or whatever. You can't come here and pretend that this embarrassing thing that it's been in the news didn't happen. I'm going to ask you about it.
Right.
And I love that, you know, and it's, you know, when Billy Idol came out and he was just like doing this whole thing about how rock and roll and blah, 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 what he was. And Letterman's looking at him like, you're just an absurd ass, basically. And then he says, oh yeah, drugs, blah, blah. And he's like, your parents must be very proud. It's just really puts him in his place. But you know, I like that you're the host of a late night show. At that time, you'd think, well, yeah, here they are to promote their movie or their book or whatever. Book, doubtful, but a movie or a TV show. And he just wasn't having it. So I loved that, and it was just, it felt like fresh, and anything can happen.
You talk a lot about how late night, especially, is a marathon and not a sprint. And I feel like that's one of the things that in no highlight package can really do justice of Letterman taking the whole. I mean, the whole show's like the way the pace of the show went. The fact that I watched one from like the mid 80s a few months ago, and the whole thing is kind of delightful. And you, I think you miss. You know, if all you do is look at a highlight package of the pre-taped bits from the last 20 years or whatever, you're missing that they undermined like every single thing day in, day out. They would break from format in every conceivable way, and that you can only appreciate that by watching it for weeks and weeks and weeks and understanding what they're doing.
Exactly, and he was, you know, and now I don't think we watch TV like that. I mean, I could be wrong. There could be some kid in college who. Was me in college and is watching late night that way now and is you know maybe tripping out over Fallon or Corden or whoever, but I don't think we watch it that way anymore. I think we hear about the good bits and then we watch it or we'll watch something if it's on. I mean for late night TV for me I it's not appointment television anymore, and so I end up watching viral stuff, and you do miss those great moments where you're. And sometimes you only watch it because, you know, he's going to have this actor on or right. This director, and I want to see that. So then I'll watch it. And then you're like, oh, this is why I used to watch shows, right? I mean, you'd say, because this interview is really good, and he's an interesting person, and rather than just the taped bit. So, yeah, he's been kind of amazing over the run of things. And it's easy to forget, too, that – We pin Letterman as like the stodgy curmudgeon guy, whereas Leno was, I want you to be my friend so badly. I will entertain you. I'll jump on my head. I'll be your monkey. And Letterman didn't want that. But that when there was moments, you know, where his humanity came out, people were really kind of amazed. You look at 9/11 or you look at Dave's heart surgery when he almost died. Those things, when he came back out and he talked honestly, especially about New York and 9/11, all the things that happened through the years, he really could put voice to how we felt as a country. And you wouldn't think that because he was such a snarky, curmudgeonly guy. And you didn't think of him as a heart guy who would be emotional, but he could really do it. And he was amazing when he did it.
You think looking back, do you think the not getting the Tonight Show? This is my theory, is that I think not getting the Tonight Show was the best thing for all parties involved, because he would have had to go to L.A. and basically do Johnny's show. And instead, he got to stay in New York and be grumpy at NBC, which is him at his best, and have something to kind of like fight against, which was NBC and Jay Leno and all of that. And I just kind of imagine, I'm not quite sure if it would have been as good if he had actually gotten that dream job.
Oh, I 1,000% agree with that, because, you know, look, even when Conan got the job, it's like, be careful what you wish for, you know? I mean, not only that he got undermined, but like, I didn't want to watch him on that. He was butter. He just became buttery. And if you think back at the time, you know, Conan was like, it's a guy who kind of made it because everybody thought he was going to fail, and then he didn't fail. And he always wanted to be in that chair. You don't want to be in that chair because you have to. There was only one Carson, and then after that, you either had to be Leno, and you couldn't have any sharp edges. There was no right angles, and Letterman is all right angles. So it's like, you're totally right. He got to stay in New York where he belongs, and he got to be bitter. And his stuff where he was made fun of NBC when he was on NBC was great, and even when he went to CBS, making fun of NBC was even better. So it definitely worked out for the best for late night, I think.
I have one last question, which is a wacky one, but that I haven't asked anybody else, but I wanted to run by you because we've talked about James Corden. I wonder, so this is also about Letterman's influence. So many people, this is the circle of life, I guess, right? Like Carson was always to me like the last generation. Everybody loved him who was my parents' generation or whatever. And I liked Carson fine, but Letterman idolized him. But mm-hmm. It seems like this generation of hosts, when you talk to them about influences, they're all like at the altar of David Letterman. Like, oh, David Letterman, because you know he completely defined it, which is a funny place to be. Now he's the guy who's been on for 33 years. He's the guy that a 20-year-old would now think is just this old man who we don't understand,
right?
Which I does that seem accurate? I mean, everybody seems to have been influenced. All this whole, you know, Colbert, Jon Stewart, Jimmy Fallon, certainly Jimmy Kimmel, right?
Yes.
They're all just acolytes of David Letterman.
Absolutely. And I think that's a great reminder to people about Letterman. Because look, Letterman was my, you know, Letterman's my era he was my Carson, basically.
Yeah, me too.
And, you know, in my career as a critic, two of the best things I ever got were, I got letters from David Letterman. And, that was amazing because he's just somebody who doesn't really do that often. They came years apart, but they were both in response to something that I wrote about him. One was really just an appreciation of how talented he was and how great the show was. And then that was early on. And then the other one was, when people had sort of forgot about him for a long time, and he still had many, many years left. And I did a thing like, hey, I don't know why, like, everybody's talking about the new flavor, whether it's Leno or whoever, but here's the master. And I did this whole thing, and he really, really appreciated it and sent me a letter. So I have both of those. I actually framed one of them, my first one, because I was like, what?
Wow.
So that was nice. But yeah, he's my guy. So it's great to hear, like, Kimmel, who I love, come out flat out and say, look, I'm in this business because of Letterman, and Letterman was the best. And of course, Kimmel, famous for not letting Leno have, like, do any of his "hey, let's be friends" thing. And Kimmel was having none of that. And in some ways, he was more mad at Leno than Letterman was, which is kind of funny. And yeah, and all these people, the reason that you see this Corden and Fallon and all these people is because you look back, and especially as comics too, and people who were in comedy. They saw how talented he was, and that he wasn't a suck up, and he was real, and he did things that were, you know, he did things that were fresh, and I think that's when maybe these guys were watching it at a time where they're like, man, I want to try that, I want to do that, and I'm happy that they are, because I don't think any of this new generation, even Corden, who's such a super likable guy, or even you know, I don't think anybody really wanted to take over, and be the next Carson. Or like be that way. They wanted to. The new generation kind of wanted to put their own mark. Only Leno really wanted to be known as, like, I'm in the big seat. And I think, just like you said prior, that Letterman not getting the job and going out and just being himself and being in New York, that's when you create your followers, and that's when he really showed what a true genius he was, and it clearly rubbed off on so many other people. For late night.
Sometimes I think Corden's earnestness is actually, like, I wonder if that signals something about, you know, the limits of an ironic detachment at the format. Like, I almost wonder if Corden being earnest is a good thing, in the sense that he's like, hey, we could also do a show that's just a fun show and not deconstructing what it is to be in show business. And I don't know, maybe the wheel is turning back to right. Theoretically, there has to be a reaction to the reaction. And like James Corden being honest and earnest and less ironic about everything.
Well, I mean, and also look at Fallon, you know, Fallon is just a good guy, and he's goofy. He's sometimes too goofy for people. He's not the world's greatest interviewer, obviously, but, you know, he's great. And Corden, I was checking in recently, on his show, and, I like the format. He's likable. And boy, he's hit a home run with the karaoke in the car thing. That's such a great shtick. And they do such great editing on that. And it really highlights his talents. Whether it was him or it was producers who came up with it, it was like, okay, this is how we take James Corden's multi-talented personality and make it come out. You stick him in a car with somebody else and you just do karaoke songs. It's awesome. So, he's doing well, and there is no bitterness or snark, really to him. So it's good.
Yeah. All right. That's great. Thank you.
Excellent. Sure.
It's going to be a good one. Yeah, I talked to Aaron Barnard. He said he only met Letterman one time, and he said it was exactly as awkward as you would ever expect it to be. Because he was interviewing Rob Burnett at the Ed Sullivan Theater, and Letterman, like, came in and was like, hey, good to meet you. And it was just like, yeah, super awkward. And I said to Aaron, I've had that dream. No, seriously, I've had the dream where I've met David Letterman, and it's been super awkward.
Super awkward. Yes, it just yeah. Not How that could it just not goes be? Badly. Yeah, but it's just awkward.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's not really a social person.
No.
I think that's probably why I was surprised to get the letters. I was like, what? Really?
I don't know, but that's that other part of him, right? It's the Midwestern. I mean, it almost takes the, you know, friendly Midwesterner kind of person to be the one who ends up getting the talk show and breaking up the talk show format. But I think he's always had that Midwestern, like, politeness and, you know, gosh golly kind of aspect of him too, which is why it's a nice combination. So I'm not surprised. His you know, his Dorothy raised him right. Write a thank you letter, yeah. David.
Are you getting into it all about like the end of the run? Because it is kind of sad, I will say.
Yeah.
I mean, in that I think that he's, you know, that he, I know he stayed too long, but it's just, he looks tired.
Yeah,
he looks tired and old.
I mean, he's decided to retire. I've been asking people if they watch the show regularly, and most of them say no, you know, they don't. Mm-hmm. I don't. I watch it a few times a year, depending on who's on. But again, he's the man now. It's, I think, what we've said in a couple of these interviews. It's hard to, you can't play that role of being the rebel when you're a 65-year-old right. multimillionaire who's at the top of his, you know, job. Yeah. And has worked it for 33 years. You can't pretend to be what you're not. And so that limits him. But, you know, he's just putting together a broadcast every week and still doing, you know, and still making lots of money for CBS and getting viewers and all of that thing. But, yeah, I mean, he obviously thinks it's time to go. And I think he's right.
I think he's right, too. And so we'll see. I'm hoping there's some spark and the little victory lap here at the end is going to be nice to watch,
yeah.
though.
Yeah, I just set my TiVo to start recording them every night again.
There you go.
Yeah.
I'm going to start that too. When is he leaving again? I can't even remember.
It's in a month.
That's the scary part.
It's like mid to late May. It's like the end of May sweeps. So yeah, it's like 5 weeks away or something.
Okay. I got to get back on it. That's a good reminder. All righty.
Time for one last appreciation, I suppose.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Another one coming.
Put it on the list.
Yeah, definitely.
So my first question for you is what are your memories of discovering the Letterman show? When did that happen, and what do you remember from that period?
You know, I don't remember the exact year. It was obviously during the NBC years.
Sure.
I was not a watcher from the beginning. I'm never a watcher from anything from the beginning. Also, when he started, I was 10 years old and not really staying up till 12:30 at night. But it would have had to have been after 1984, because that's when we got a VCR in our house. And I had seen, you know, the clips, the wacky stunts and the thrill cam and the monkey cam and that sort of jibed with my sensibility at the time. And the first episode I remember taping, I believe the stunt that night was they were following the Australian Stock Exchange throughout the program. And so there was this ticker of Australian stocks like running throughout the program, and occasionally Paul Schaefer, they invested in the company, and Paul Schaefer would occasionally scream, "Oh God, we're ruined," whenever the price dropped. So I remember that bit, and you know, that worked for me. I thought that was great. I think Ricardo Montalban was the guest, because they were asking him about Corinthian leather.
Oh, it was that episode. That's something.
I believe so. And in which we learned that Corinthian leather is totally made up.
Yeah, yeah.
It just sounds nice when Ricardo Montalban is saying it.
Fine Corinthian leather from New Jersey, I believe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Corinth, New Jersey.
Yeah, Corinth, New Jersey. Yeah. It's a suburb of Newark. So you mentioned the monkey cam and things like that. What was the appeal as an impressionable person? Part of my theory here is that there is a span of years of people who are of a certain age, who that show just hit them exactly right and formed some of their comic sensibility, came around seeing that thing in the 80s. And if people from about 30 to, you know, 50 or 55 right now are that age group who was just, you know, it had something that appealed.
I think when you're in your teens and 20s, you want to see something weird. something or something that looks like it doesn't belong, and why are they allowing this to happen? And then that really touches a button in the teenage anarchist mind that, yeah, we're getting away with something here, that a guy can put on an Alka-Seltzer suit or a Velcro suit and put that on TV. And sometimes even when the jokes fall flat, as they often did in the monologue, it had a whole sense that someone had snuck into a studio and was doing a show, and the network people didn't quite understand it. And again, another great bit that I think really cemented that show with me was when GE bought NBC and they brought the fruit basket, and it just went disastrously with the GE handshake. I would agree with your theory that you want at a certain age you want to see TV that doesn't feel like it should be TV. I think for people who are younger than me and therefore awful, Conan O'Brien did that with the various bits that were kind of confusing to me, because I was an old man by the time Conan O'Brien hit his stride. So why they shouldn't allow this on TV, whereas people 10 years younger than me, right, were probably.
Why is that bear masturbating? I don't understand.
No, that's you can't have that on television. Whereas if I think David Letterman had put a masturbating bear on TV, I would have said, hey, that's great.
Right. Right. Well, it's the another thought I had is I feel like one of the ways that something like Letterman's show works on you is because it's undermining the premise of the format in a way. Like Johnny Carson owned the show essentially, right? And Dave Letterman looked up to him, but the Carson show was, it had fun, it had bits and it had stuff, but it was like, it was the adult show, it was professional, and it had like the way things are done. And subverting the way things are done when you're of that age, I think, is incredibly effective. And I think that's one of the things that Letterman show had, is that you as a kid, you start by learning how things are, because you, right, and you think that that's how they have to be. And then somebody comes along and says, what if we did a talk show that like you said, that looks like they should not have been allowed in to make it.
And I believe that was how they opened the morning show. They had Larry Bud Melman come on and say, "Oh, this, we don't know why we allowed this to happen. Please look away." So that's great. Because of Letterman, I started watching Ernie Kovacs reruns. And again, even though that was a show that was on decades earlier, it looked like something that should not be allowed on television, because they would just do these ridiculous things and then end them abruptly and move on to something else. And I think there's a certain genre of show that appeals to that mindset.
So when you went to college, I know you wrote for the college humor newspaper. How would you define, whether it's that era or any other, because you've obviously been writing funny stuff your whole life.
People would disagree with you, but go on.
Yes.
I don't disagree with your premise.
What do you think that the David Letterman stuff, that sense of humor, that sensibility, influenced not just how do I want to phrase this? Influenced how you view comedy, how you view humor.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, it's a big influence. There were a lot of different influences, I think, from that era. You and I happened to go to college just at the tail end of the big stand up boom of the 80s, and so we had some influences there as to making us think what's funny and what's not. But certainly Letterman with the national broadcasting reach. Subconsciously or not, influences what you're doing. And you mentioned the college newspaper that I, the humor paper that I worked for, which had lists at the front.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
That is, you know, you mentioned it. We were right there at the tail end of the, of that particular comedy boom.
Right.
I remember exactly how that ended, which is that they took all the stand-up comedians and they lined them up in front of a brick wall and then they...
Yeah. There were no survivors.
There were no survivors. The very small room with a brick wall and then
only
they all died.
Only Gallagher survived because he hid behind the watermelon.
Behind the watermelon.
And it exploded and that's how he got his gimmick.
That's right. That's right. I feel like you're so impressionable at that age, like you said, and you're looking for something anarchic. And that... Also, I mean, I don't want to overblow it, but irony, you know, David, like Aaron Barnhart was telling me, you know, and you mentioned Ernie Kovacs, it's not like David Letterman invented irony, and yet I feel like he was the, for our generation, he was the most prominent person to inject that in into our lives, that he was taking this, television was... You know, everything. It was a monolith. It was what society was based on, and there weren't that many channels, and it was like, this is what it is. And then here comes this guy with his, you know, homespun Midwestern charm, and he is breaking every rule that is possible to be broken. And it just, I think that I can look at comedy now and talk shows now, and the people who do them will even say, it's like Letterman was this huge influence. So I don't know. This is not a question, but
no, I think another example from that era would be Steve Martin's stand-up comedy, because he would get up on stage and not really do jokes,
exactly.
But it was more jokes about jokes, or jokes about what you think jokes should be. And I would recommend to the listeners that they go hunt down. It's a Steve Martin comedy concert film from 1978. I think it is actually on the iTunes store if they want to rent it or buy it. It's from the Universal Amphitheater, and they filmed a thing years later, a little introduction to it where it's Steve Martin lecturing people on comedy in a very pompous way, and one of the people he's lecturing is Dave Letterman. It's Dave Letterman, Paul Simon, Henny Youngman, and I want to say Alan King is the other person
wow.
in the room. Yeah, and Paul Simon keeps asking him questions about music.
Sure, of course.
Do you think a sad song is more effective if it's played as a happy song? Paul, I keep telling you, I'm only answering questions about my comedy today.
You mentioned Paul Simon and Steve Martin. I mean, Saturday Night Live is a part of this story, too.
Yep.
I mean, a big difference being that Saturday Night Live did whatever, 20 shows a year, and these talk shows were on. And so the pacing and the everything is completely different, because you can't, you don't have one show a week. You've got four shows a week, and, you know, and you're going for most of the year.
Right.
So, but it is, and in fact, I think you could argue the Letterman Show is a reaction to that, by NBC, by Carson, because Carson wanted to remain control. And I know you and I have both read that the Hill and Weingrad Saturday Night book, right?
Oh, sure, sure,
which. You know, Carson saw Saturday Night Live as a threat because he was Mr. Late Night, and this was this young group of people with a comedy show. And I think that the Letterman Show was a bulwark against Lorne Michaels invading his turf. And if you look today, Lorne Michaels runs NBC Late Night. He has all the shows. They're all Lorne Michaels shows. First, he got the Conan O'Brien show, and now the Tonight Show and the Late Night Show are both produced by Lorne Michaels. It's his show now.
And never underestimate how much Johnny Carson hated Saturday Night Live when it came out. I believe his quote about the original cast was, "They couldn't improv a fart at a bean eating contest."
Yeah, well, I think how he was the unquestioned king, and then suddenly there was something on his own network that was exposing the fact that he was not, you know, his audience was aging with him, and even though he was the king, there was a little crack in the I don't know what a king has, in the king's crown. Yeah, that's it. There's my metaphor. And here we are. And I mean, Johnny Carson wasn't wrong, because now Lorne Michaels has inherited that same that same crown. I want to talk about the speaking of Johnny Carson, him leaving and Jay Leno replacing him. I don't know if you have any thoughts about that or memories of that period about what went down and then what came after.
I remember liking Leno at one point when he was a regular guest on Letterman.
He was a good Letterman guest.
He was a really good Letterman guest. In fact, I still I still quote a thing from one of the Leno appearances whenever my wife Lisa, who podcast listeners may know, is complaining about something. So have we reached the what's your beef part of the program?
Mm-hmm.
Which is what he said to Leno.
What's my beef? Dave, it was all set up, right? Like Dave was doing what Johnny did, which is mm-hmm. I'm going to make you look good here. This is mm-hmm. and Leno look good. He was probably my favorite Letterman guest in that era.
And even when he was the guest host on the Tonight Show, it was still pretty. Hey, this is neat because it's someone who's young and has a worldview not unlike our own. And then he became the host through machinations we weren't privy to at the time. But it just seemed so middle of the road and watered down. And over the years, you just felt every last edge of Jay Leno being buffered off until he was a bowling ball, basically.
So one of my theses is that the CBS thing was the best thing that could have happened to Letterman.
Yeah, because I think the transition from Carson to Letterman would have been fine from Carson's point of view, because one gets the impression from reading biographies to the extent that Carson he had more of a bond with Letterman, I think. But it's very hard to replace Carson, and it's very hard to, as Conan O'Brien found, it's very hard to step into this 11:30 time slot where you're entertaining my dad. Who has stayed awake through the evening news and just wants something not terribly threatening or challenging to come on the air. And as much as Letterman sort of drew in, wasn't doing quite the late night stuff once he got the late show on CBS, he was still doing odd and unusual things like Will It Float and whatnot.
Right.
To where I don't think that would have gone over like a Led Zeppelin for the Tonight Show's audience of my parents, who are easily confused.
Right. And at the time, we thought, what's the worst that could happen, right? I mean, Letterman take over, he would have run the show for 20 years, and Leno could take it over and run the show for 20 years. But I think with Conan O'Brien, we've seen what the worst is that could happen, which is that NBC could have given it to Letterman, and after a couple of years been like, oh, no.
Let's bring
in Jay Leno. And instead, Letterman got – and also keep in mind, Letterman would have moved to L.A.,
mm-hmm.
He would have had all that pressure. I think he had positioned himself to live up to Johnny Carson's standard and to smooth out his own rough edges at that point. And then instead what happened was he got to be mad. He got to feel, put upon. He got to stay in New York and get that new thing on Broadway. And he got to be like the king of New York. And even when he was second to Leno in the ratings, I mean, CBS loved it because they were making nothing in late night. And the people in New York loved him, and he was extremely visible. And
I think you've really undersold Pat Sajak's contributions to CBS.
Oh, man. Yeah, that Pat Sajak show. Woo.
Mm-hmm.
But so, I think in the end, Letterman ended up doing a show that he got to be. He got to have his moment of riding high, but then he got to be his old grumpy self with Leno doing the Tonight Show. That was like the extended GE handshake where he got to just rail against it forever while staying in New York and doing, being the, I think always being on top, I think never would become David Letterman. I think he would always find a way to make himself the put upon underdog. So I think in the end, it worked out, even though it was his dream that he didn't get to fulfill.
Never underestimate the motivating power of unbridled fury.
Yeah. Yeah. And the competition is good too.
Another way that David Letterman is influenced.
That angst. Well, yeah. So talking to Aaron Barnhart, but in the Bill Carter book, it's very clear. I mean, Letterman's such a incredibly self-critical guy. Didn't was was self-loathing, you could argue, right? Fascinating figure. But I think that I don't even want to think about what would have happened if he had moved to L.A. and been the host of The Tonight Show, which I know he desperately wanted, but I just don't think it would have been good.
I think if he reflects upon it now, he probably would agree that it worked out for the best.
Yeah, I would hope so. I would think so. What do you think? So we're moving rapidly forward in time. So my last question is about it's almost like coming full circle. My early memories of Johnny Carson were that this was what was done on television, and he had celebrities on and they talked and he did a monologue and it was full of topical bits and it was funny. And I learned all of that. I recorded Carson's monologue when I was in high school and the whole David Letterman show, but I did watch Carson's monologue.
And they had a show in the 80s syndicated, which was all the
Carson's
all
comedy sketches. Classics.
Yep. Yep. So you could do the Karnak, the Magnificent.
And Blabby.
Uh-huh.
Get out of your, what is it? Go to the Slauson cutoff. Get out of your car. Cut off your Slauson.
Mm-hmm.
Every time I go past a Slauson sign in L.A., I think of that bit.
I used to live by Slauson.
So that was the establishment, and David Letterman was the undermining young guy. And I think about where we are now, and I think this is full circle, right? Is that everybody else who works in the comedy business talks about how they were influenced by David Letterman, and David Letterman is still doing a show. He's just about to retire. But mm-hmm. I have the feeling like, you know, I haven't watched the show regularly and I don't even know how long. I see a handful of them a year. I feel like, I feel like it's great that Dave is still out there and I'm going to really miss him when he's gone. But, you know, he's at that Johnny Carson point now. And it makes me feel old thinking about this. But this is how life works, is that he's going to be feted over the next little bit for being who he is. But the fact is that, you know, his influence is for, you know, teenagers and people in their 20s, his influence is entirely secondary now. It is the people they love point to him as an influence.
Right.
Which makes me feel old. Are you the same way? Do you watch that show at all anymore?
No. Yeah. First off, it's on way too late for me.
Sure.
second off, occasionally I'll be up at that hour and not watching sports. If I'm up at that hour, it's generally because I'm watching an old movie or I'm watching sports, but I'll flip by CBS and see him and, oh, it's Dave Letterman. And, you know, it's, I think you and I are also, not to be cranky old men, but it's not what it was in the old days, is it? It's not young, risk-taking David Letterman. Instead, it's David Letterman taking his victory lap.
Or yeah.
And it's not quite the same. I watched a top 10 list he did about a month ago regarding the whole bigot law in Indiana, and that was making fun of Mike Pence. And, you know, it was all right. It was not his best material, but at a certain point, comedy doesn't last forever. Comedy is very much in the moment.
And he cannot – also, he cannot pretend that he's a 40-year-old or a 35-year-old guy who is up and coming and wants to stick it to the man. He is a multi-millionaire.
He is the man.
He is the man. And you can't. And Johnny Carson was the man. And so you get to that point. I mean, as much as I say
And Johnny Carson could get away with it a little bit more because he would do jokes about how his wife took him to the cleaners at the divorce hearing or how he's playing tennis or all that. And that was never really part of Letterman's shtick.
Right. Because his shtick was that he wasn't the man and he was fighting the man. And it's tough to do that. So he ended up getting, with Letterman, he ended up getting broader and being like, wacky things are happening, right? Which just never appealed to me on the CBS show. In fact, I would say, I was talking to Aaron about this. I wonder what you think about this. When Dave went to CBS and then that first show premiered and he was on CBS, he was at 11:30 and they had the big theater and the ratings were amazing.
Where the hell are the talking cats?
Exactly.
Singing cats.
Where the hell are the singing cats? you could view that as this is the start of something big. But in hindsight, I view that as like graduation or the moment of victory.
Yeah.
And it's like, here we are. We've made it. We liked this guy on his crazy show, and now he is the big time. And then everything that happened after that was just, I kind of think the long, slow fade, where it was like, now he's here. He's established. And he will do this for a long time, and it will just gradually fade away, and that's how life works, which is not what I thought at the time.
I'm going to tell a story that has very little to do with David Letterman, but I hope to loop it back, so right. Bear with me. In the 90s, when I was young and hip, MTV approached our little TV writing collective about doing a show for him. And we went into the pitch meeting, and it didn't go well. And at one point, the conversation turned to, "Well, is there what kind of shows on MTV do you like?" And I remember citing The State, which was the sketch comedy show it ran in like a couple of years, 93, 94. And the executive sort of looked at me and wrinkled his nose and like I had brought up a terrible smelly memory and said, "Oh, The State didn't do well for us." And I mentioned this because 20 years hence, those guys are all doing like writing TV and movies, and their progeny have sprung forth. And it's, as you were saying, it's a graduation moment. The things that the mainstream kind of rejects and that the suits kind of reject eventually become the suits. And I think we saw that with Letterman on the CBS show.
Yeah. Yeah.
There, tied it in.
You brought it all the way back.
Brought it home.
Anything else that you would like to talk about that on this subject that you think is worth expressing?
Are we going to talk about the time you and I went to go see the Letterman show? We can.
Oh yeah, let's do that.
We can.
Let's do that. I got to see the studio at NBC, but during a tour.
Right.
So I got to see that, which was amazing. It was the late night with David Letterman. It was when he was doing it, and I was a standby ticket holder, and I didn't get in. And they said, "Do you want to go see Donahue instead?" And I said, "No, I don't want to go see." And I still have my standby ticket somewhere, my written number 20 on it, and I think they took four people. It's a very tiny studio, but at the escalators that they did comedy bits around there, right at 30 Rock. But then you and I entered. We were going to be at Macworld Expo in what, like 2001 or 2002?
This was 2002.
And,
yes, 2002.
And you know, you can sign up on their website and put in request dates, but it's like good luck ever getting tickets. And we got tickets to see the Late Show.
The golden ticket.
And they said, "Yeah, you've got the golden ticket, so you just need to come back at this time and
don't have to queue up for 1,000 hours ahead of time."
Yeah. That's what they told us.
That's what they told us. It was a lie.
I was looking at all the people in line thinking, "You guys are suckers."
Yeah.
We're gonna march right in there. And indeed, we didn't need to line up to go see it because they put us in the balcony behind the last row in folding chairs.
Yeah, we could actually not see the set. We watched the show on monitors.
Yeah, you could see
parts of it.
You could see the desk, and part of the band. But like when he was cooking with Mario Batali, you could not see that at all.
Do you remember who else was on that show?
Because
I do. I can tell you.
There was a really. Was there an interesting musical guest on that show?
Interesting to me. Solomon Burke. Yes. Catherine Keener was the main guest.
Ah, yes, that's right. Actress Catherine Keener, chef Mario Batali.
And there was a little walk-on bit by Robin Williams.
Oh, wow. I forgot that entirely.
Yeah, he
just came out and ran around.
He was dressed as a bicyclist. In the short pants and whatnot, and did it. So two of the people who appeared on that show are no longer with us.
That's true.
Boy, that the passage of time, man.
You know, I get that mixed up because Solomon Burke on that show, and then I get that mixed up with Screamin' Jay Hawkins, who was on the Dennis Miller show.
Do you remember who we saw there?
That was Screamin' Jay Hawkins and Sally Kirkland.
Sally Kellerman.
You sure it wasn't Sally Kirkland?
I think it was Sally Kellerman. I don't know who Sally Kirkland is. We'll edit this later to make it look like we know what we're talking about. And Richard Donner and his wife were also guests on that show.
Oh, well, it could have been Sally Kellerman. Well, anyway, yeah, and Richard Donner and Lauren Shuler Donner, because there's nothing more exciting than having movie producers on as a guest on the talk show.
Yes, to talk about the I think, radio flyer they were on to talk about, maybe?
That could be.
I don't know. It was not a star-studded panel, the Dennis Miller Show.
I also went to see, and this is of interest to nobody, but I saw the 8th anniversary special, which was at the Universal Amphitheater, the David Letterman 8th anniversary special.
Those are nice.
And that was nice. We were very far back, and the thing I remember about that is I forgot to bring my glasses. That was when I wasn't wearing my glasses very much, but let me tell you, when we were that far back, I couldn't see anything. It was just a big fuzzy thing down there.
So it was much like our experience like a decade or so later at the actual
exactly where I would wear my glasses and couldn't see anything.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, well, alas. But I did get to see that. I think that's good to be able to have some sort of connection like that with something that's part of your kind of formative
And you years. Had the late night shirt?
I did. I had a late night with David Letterman shirt for a long, long time. And I still have a late show shirt. But I was looking online and thinking that some enterprising person needs to make a knockoff of the late night with David Letterman shirt. Because that was really in it. Although – somebody I saw somewhere, they did at some point make a late show shirt in the exact same style as the old late night shirt, where it's the collegiate like sports logo thing.
Right.
But yeah, I did. I bought that. That was the same time I went to that taping and didn't get in. I bought the late night shirt in the NBC store. That was good times.
And I once interviewed Larry Melman in a limousine.
That was that in the CBS era? That was in college, right?
That was in the CBS era. Yeah.
He was Calvert DeForest at that point.
Yes.
His real name.
That was one of the few interviews where I just got giggly because you're sitting. It's just so preposterous. You're sitting in a limousine with this tiny little man who's talking about. And I asked him about the time Dave sent him to Tierra del Fuego, and he mm-hmm. begged to come home.
Yeah,
David, I'm so sick.
He only got to like southern Mexico. I think.
Oh yeah, he did not make it.
No, he didn't make it to Panama.
No, it was the Goodwill tour.
Yeah,
there was no Goodwill.
There was none.
Yeah, so we talked about that mostly in a limousine.
He seemed like a nice man who didn't fully understand what he was gotten.
He
into.
Was a very nice man who had no idea what the joke was.
Yeah,
and but that was what made it a good joke.
Yeah. Yeah, Aaron and I were talking about his welcoming people at the bus terminal with the hot towels and the terrible microphone technique. So he would be like, tell me what you're going to do. Just fantastic.
Yeah.
He had no idea what he was doing. Beautiful.
And there was a winery in Temecula where I used to be a newspaper reporter. Chilurzo's Winery. It's long gone now. The owner of it was he made his fortune as a lighting director for TV shows and whatnot. Mostly for Jeopardy. He did the lighting for Jeopardy for years and years. But I guess he did the lighting for perhaps the anniversary show that you were at. Mm. And whenever late night was in LA, he would do the lighting for those. Anyhow, there was a picture of Letterman at the winery. And it was, Vince, thank you for the wine now. Thank you very much for the wine. I'm now a hopeless alcoholic. Love, Dave.